You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Dana Frank. Dana Frank is Professor of History Emerita at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her articles about human rights and U.S. policy in Honduras have appeared in numerous news outlets, including the New York Times, The Nation, and Foreign Affairs. She has testified before both the U.S. Congress and the Canadian Parliament. And her book, which I highly recommend, is called The Long Honduran Night: Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. Dana Frank, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Oh, thanks so much. It's such a great thing to be on.
Thank you for coming on. Thank you for writing this tremendous book, which we can, there's no way in the world we can touch most of it. It's a detailed account. I highly recommend it, The Long Honduran Night. But for probably the billionth time you've done it, for anyone who hasn't heard or has forgotten, can you give us briefly what happened June 28th, 2009, and in the following months and years?
Yeah, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of the military coup in 2009, when President Manuel Zelaya, the democratically elected president of Honduras, was deposed in a military coup and packed on his pajamas, in his pajamas to Costa Rica. Now, he had been democratically elected. He was not from the left. He came from one of the traditional right-wing parties, but was starting to move to the center and do some progressive things, which threatened the Honduran elites who backed this coup in all the branches of the government. And that, in turn, was not only this huge criminal act and a destruction of the rule of law and constitutional order, but it opened the door for the destruction of the rule of law in Honduras. So very quickly, the coup stabilized with U.S. backing, and we can talk about that, but the U.S. did everything it could, after initially condemning the coup, to make sure that the coup leader, Roberto Micheletti, was treated as an equal partner in negotiations with the sovereign president of Honduras, and then played out the clock until elections several months later. And most all the candidates had pulled out of the elections by that point because there was no civil liberties and the military was occupying things. And then that the government that came in through that election, has that party's been in power ever since. We would call it the post-coup regime, which is still very much in power.
And if anyone in the Obama administration had some kind of secret theory that that would be a compromise that would benefit Honduras, they certainly would have been proven wrong, in that horror followed upon horror with U.S. facilitation all along the way in the years after the coup, correct?
Yeah, it's not just a question of, you know, there's been a lot of attention to the fact, quite rightly, that Hillary Clinton green-lighted the process through which the post-coup regime came to power through a bogus election. And, of course, it was with Obama's approval. It's not just on Hillary Clinton's shoulders. But also it's on the shoulders of all sorts of folks ever since, including John Kerry, who continued to support the regime, and, of course, Trump. And the U.S., you know, gave this regime green light after green light. There was an election in 2013 when a new opposition party may or may not have won the election, and the U.S. didn't was part of the process of giving the imprimatur to the current dictator, Juan Orlando Hernandez, and it has supported the current dictator, Juan Orlando Hernandez, ever since. Including when he ran for re-election in 2016 and 17 in clear violation of the Honduran Constitution. The Honduran Constitution says you absolutely cannot run for re-election. You can't even advocate it as a sitting president. And the Supreme Court that he himself, in yet another criminal act, had overthrown in the so-called technical coup of 2012, when he was president of Congress, that Supreme Court then ruled like, well, Constitution doesn't apply, and it's just like the United States, the Supreme Court has no right to do that. And then with that green light, he then ran for president last year, and the U.S. State Department gave a green light to that interpretation of the Constitution and allowed him to run. And then last November, not this last one, the one before, November of 2017, Juan Orlando was again, an illegal candidate, and when he There was an opposition candidate of the unified opposition named Salvador Nasrallah, and when the election returns came in the night of the election, it was very clear that Nasrallah was winning by several points when 57% of the votes were counted, and the government just shut down the computers for 2 days and then gradually over the next week and a half let out 5% of the votes at outcome at the time. And lo and behold, he won by 1.5 points at the end, and the U.S. just gave that a green light, rubber-stamped that election, and he remains in power, despite the fact that 22 people were killed by the military, mostly by the military police, while in the act of protesting or even watching a protest after the elections.
The activists in Honduras during these years were facing kidnappings, torture, murder. And there's a moment you describe when you spent a lot of time in Honduras and a lot of time in Washington, D.C. You describe going into a meeting at the U.S. State Department with a State Department official and trying to tell this person that some people had just that morning been kidnapped in Honduras. And you describe a response of cold, willing obliviousness. Can you recount what happened?
Well, you know, I don't generally in the book talk about my meetings with the State Department, the embassy, because the rules are that if you talk about them, they'll never talk to you again. And this is one of the ways in which they exercise power over reporters and academics and all kinds of people who would like to make public what the State Department does. You know, the part of the arc of the book is my own experiences and my own learning experience. And, you know, I've been a U.S. history professor my whole life. I've known a fair amount about foreign policy, but watching how the State Department operates and its nefarious tactics in live time and how the empire works has been really chilling, and watching that over and over again. And that was just one little incident. I was with I was actually in Washington to testify before the House, and I was with a prominent Honduran former judge who had been deposed for opposing the coup, and we went to meet with a State Department official. And I got an email as we were walking in the meeting saying that two people that worked for a U.S.-based NGO that had been accompanying an at-risk community had just been kidnapped at gunpoint by 40 armed men. And we didn't know entirely if these two people were safe, and the official says, oh, get back to me with the information later. And for me, it's like a crisis is a small thing, but that, like, later, and we didn't even know if those were U.S. citizens. I mean, of course, we don't want to say U.S. citizens are more important than anyone else, but in the context of the obligations of the State Department, the fact that it was like, send me the information later, when I thought he would immediately go into overdrive to make sure these people are safe. And, you know, and that's, of course, just a tip of the iceberg of the scary things the State Department does, like denying that it was meeting with the National Director of Police, who was a documented death squad leader and who the U.S. was supporting at the time. His name was El Tigre Bonilla. I mean, this kind of thing goes on over and over and over again, and there's a lot of as you said, there's details in the middle of the stories. There's also details in the book because I wanted the reader to see how it actually plays out in real time.
Yeah, we're speaking with Dana Franken. The book is The Long Honduran Night, Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. The activism, as you recount, was new to you, and I think it was in some ways thrilling and fulfilling to you, but it was also surprising, as you recount, to most people, to see the level of activism that rose up in Honduras after the coup. This was new there.
Well, you know, there's a long, long history of activism in Honduras, but not at that level. Of course, when the coup happened, there was this huge coalition that came together, the National Front of Popular Resistance, that with powerful presence with hundreds of thousands of people in the streets for 2 years. And, you know, it was our own fantasy coalition of the labor movement, the women's movement, the LGBT movement, middle-class people committed to constitutional rule of law, the Afro-Indigenous movement, the Indigenous movement, campesinos, the human rights community. I mean, it was really this amazing, amazing coalition, and that drops out of the story of Honduras, you know, but those elements that came together were in place before, but it was invisible at some level. But also, when the coup happened, the resistance just exploded culturally. I mean, new songs and graffiti and young people just completely transformed, and it was a really amazing and beautiful thing in the middle of all the horror. And one of the things I was trying to do in the book is to capture the beautiful creativity and bravery of the resistance to this day, and then in the middle of all the horror and repression, because I think the media coverage and maybe we can talk about it, Honduras, is that it's just unrelenting horror. And there is certainly unrelenting horror, but there's also unrelenting bravery, resistance, and joie de vivre, and joy, and dancing, and birthday parties. And I put those things in the book that I was part of because, or not part of, but various stories, because I want the reader to grasp that it's also people in struggle, and that's a beautiful thing. Because so often the narrative we get is just powerless people sobbing in the morgue. And there are many other forms of resistance in the book. The land struggles, land recuperation struggles by campesinos whose land was stolen, middle-class people in the so-called indignados movement protesting against the stealing of money of as many as $90 million from the National Health Service by current President Juan Orlando Hernandez and his party when he was running for election in 2013. Libre, the opposition party that came out of the resistance, which, you know, has probably won in 2013. It has the second biggest number in Congress and in coalition with Salvador Nasrallah, a centrist figure, won the election a year ago. So that whole story of successful resistance and electoral power and power in the streets has so disappeared from the U.S. mainstream media narrative of what's going on in Honduras. It's just like nothing but suffering victims.
Yeah, I was struck. I think all of that does come through in the book, and I was struck in the book by the importance of what the major corporate media in the United States decides to say or not. And there's the moment in 2012 when the media begins to cover the story a little bit in a partial way, and you published an op-ed in the New York Times that was a big part of moving the media. But I was really struck by your comment when you get to the spring of 2014 that precisely as the U.S. Congress was getting to a tipping point toward taking action on Honduras and recognizing how bad Honduras was, the State Department begins pushing out this story about the invasion of the hordes of immigrants from Honduras into the United States. This was a consciously created media event, wasn't it?
Well, you know, and first of all, just to, you know, back up here a little bit, as you underscore, by 2014, there's tremendous pushback in Congress. Conditions had been placed on the funding for Honduras starting in 2012. There were 94 members of the House that signed letters saying cut all security aid for Honduras, and these things didn't make it into the media, but by 2012, these things are starting to happen on a very big scale and questioning in the Senate as well. And right as that, the spring of 2014, right, as I say, I think there was some kind of a potential tipping point that you could see when the new ambassador, James Nealand, at his confirmation hearing, you could see it in various things that key figures were making. And then BAMO, this discovery of 57,000 undocumented, unaccompanied minors arriving at the U.S. border. Now, it was Breitbart News that blew up that story. And then that, in turn, created a lot of mainstream media attention to a so-called crisis. And a lot of that was concern about the situation of the children. But also then it got blown up into this as a threat to the United States. So, you know, the notion that 57,000 poor children arriving at the border were some kind of a military threat to the United States, it shows you how out of control things were at that moment, and that was the framework that was set that we're living with today since the caravans of the past year and this framing of them as a threat. But also what you can see in 2014 is the policy response to that by the Obama administration was to treat Juan Orlando Hernandez, as the corrupt dictator president of the country, as a heroic hero protecting the little children of Honduras, and the U.S. poured even more money, right as when they conceivably could have been cutting off aid, turned and poured even more money into Honduras and into Guatemala, too, where the president at the time was implicated in genocidal torture, the man, Perez Molina, who was the president at the time and who was later deposed a year later. And, you know, sort of this celebration of these terrifying figures and regimes in the name of helping the children. And it's like opening the coffers through something called the Alliance for Prosperity. And, you know, Joe Biden had a big op-ed in the New York Times in, I think, January, February of 2015 saying give $1 billion to the so-called Northern Triangle, which is Honduras, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and clumping those three countries together and saying give them lots of aid in the name of stopping migration. And that aid then got poured into precisely the sectors that are destroying livelihoods in Honduras. So that aid goes to, you know, things like not only does it go to security forces who are killing people and responsible for all kinds of human rights abuses with impunity, but it also goes into a model of economic development that is destroying livelihoods, like palm oil production, that's producers forcing campesino collectives off their land, like mining and hydroelectric projects that are forcing indigenous people off their lands, and that's why Berta Cáceres, the famous indigenous activist, was killed protesting one of these hydroelectric dams, and the maquiladora sector, which is apparel export production for the most part, that is horrible, horrible working conditions. And all of this is happening with almost no labor law enforcement under terrible conditions. So what gets called economic development in the name of helping these people is also terrifying. But more importantly, the U.S. is continuing to shore up the dangerous regime of Juan Orlando Hernandez. And, you know, the worse that things go and the more that, you know, the caravans underscore that people are fleeing that regime and its corrupt and police and military, then the U.S. says the answer is to give them even more money.
Yeah, which I don't call the security forces if they don't make anything secure, and I don't call this kind of money aid because it's not aiding anyone.
It's also tied in with drug traffickers. I mean, people may remember that the president's brother Tony Hernandez was just arrested in the United States a couple months ago, and it's established in U.S. federal court in New York to be moving large amounts of drugs and also arms, and that, you know, there's no way that it seems very unlikely that the president wouldn't know what his brother was doing, and his brother Tony was a Congress member as well, and the National Director of Security is in charge of the police. His former general has been twice named in U.S. federal court to be overseeing drug trafficking flights, and the AP established a year ago that the top three new cops, directors of the police, had been involved in cocaine trafficking. So we're actually giving money to the drug traffickers at the very top level. I mean, we're funding drug trafficking in Honduras, people that are involved in it, and then saying, oh, look, they're stopping drug trafficking. And, like, who's the threat here? You know, the threat becomes children and starving people who are going to get killed by gangs, and then the gangs are in bed with the very police that people are fleeing and that the U.S. wants to fund.
Yeah, I guess people are supposed to imagine that families send their children off alone to a foreign country because they're simply irrational monsters, rather than stopping for 30 seconds and thinking what would make someone do that would be that it's a greater risk to keep them there. And you could hand somebody this book, The Long Honduran Night, and they would understand that without having to do any thinking. But
well, there's this narrative that is out there, which is like that it's never phrased this way, that somehow it's bad parenting that is the problem here, and that these people would, you should, you know, the acting ambassador Heidi Van Poulton has been putting out tweets for the last month saying don't travel, it's dangerous, as if people don't know it's dangerous. And of course it's dangerous partly because of U.S. policy. That's what these people are, refugees from U.S. policy. And what's going on in Honduras is not a natural disaster. It's the direct result of U.S. support for this regime. And the Honduran human rights community, activist community, civil rights community, these people will be the first to say the U.S. should just get out of there and stop legitimating and funding this terrifying government. And, you know, I think some of that bad parenting stuff is tied in with historic racism, that somehow brown people can't make their own decisions about parenting and aren't wise parents. And when these people have a long history of trying to have strategies to keep themselves and their children alive.
Well, what's happening with these caravans lately?
Well, I mean, we see these caravans. The caravans have been forming for years. It's a way for people to move safely from Central America through Mexico to the border without being exploited by coyotes or people that they get paid to move people. So, and to protect themselves as they pass through Mexico in particular, where it's very, very dangerous, and I think people are aware of that. So, you know, the caravans are people who are trying, and also they're trying to seek asylum if you listen to their stories. And there has been some beautiful reporting in the last 6 months in which reporters ask people why they're traveling, and they'll say, because the police were going to kill us, because my daughter was being forced into gang, because I observed the elections and then someone and reported election abuses by election authorities, by the ruling party, and someone tried to kill me. I mean, the individual stories are very powerful about what people are fleeing, including the policies that they're fleeing. And so these people are seeking asylum under U.S. asylum laws, and then the U.S. under the Trump administration wants to abrogate the U.S.'s legal obligations and moral obligations to these folks. And these folks are fleeing U.S. policy. They're refugees of U.S. policy. And so it's not like you just even say, well, what's going down at the border, or why can't they govern themselves? We are governing them in a way that is making them die. And so it's all, this is of a piece. U.S. immigration policy doesn't just happen as the border. Not only is there this terrifying militarization of all the border states, and even, of course, places like my own backyard where people get pulled off the have been pulled off the buses and asked for their IDs and then rounded up, and that including under the Obama administration. So, I mean, what you're seeing is people that are fleeing a repressive regime and trying to follow legal asylum procedures in the United States and being barred from that by our own militarization. Up here, you have a militarization of the Honduran border, where U.S.-funded border security, border patrol in Honduras is stopping people from leaving their own country, while the U.S. military is trying to stop people from legally entering the United States and applying for asylum, and using tear gas on Mexican soil.
Your book, Dana Frank, tells this story of the past several years of all the wonderful, courageous, creative activism resisting this coup and this thuggish government, series of governments that have followed this coup. And it's a story of activism with a general pattern of things nonetheless getting worse. And so I think it's important to ask, how much worse would things have been in Honduras without the activism?
Well, you know, as a history teacher my whole life who writes about social movements and specifically about labor, it's like you're never going to get a headline in the papers that says, organizing works, you know, which it does. I mean, in terms of the solidarity in the United States, the goal has been, on the one hand, to challenge the big level policy, and on the other hand, to raise human rights issues about Honduras so that the Honduran people can live to see another day and define what it is they want and how they want to be governed on their own sovereign terms. So much of solidarity work on the ground, all a beautiful solidarity movement all over the United States involving faith-based people, labor people, all kinds of people, first and foremost Hondurans, and a lot of Salvadorans and all kinds of folks, has been to also protect individuals in the social movements. I mean, most famously, through tutors of the United States, of Europe, Canada, and also delegations down there. But, you know, that has kept people alive. But, you know, I think one of the shocks of Berta Cáceres' killing 3 years ago in March was that we thought that we at least could keep someone at her level alive, someone who'd met with the Pope, who'd been given the Goldman Environmental Prize. And when they killed her, that was a sign they'd kill anyone. But, you know, I think that even many, many more people would be dead if it wasn't for activism. I mean, the Hondurans are incredibly brave, and they keep sending the message to their government that no matter what, they're going to go in the streets. And this was challenged last year when, for the first time in decades, the Honduran government was using live bullets against Hondurans, and they had not done that after the coup. Clearly in some kind of concerted command from the top of the security forces, the police and the military police both started using live bullets and killed at least 22 people, mostly the military, in the weeks after the coup. And some of those were bystanders, or they just were shot up when they were peacefully demonstrating, or the security forces just fired randomly into crowds.
And the activism has stayed nonviolent through these years.
I mean, you know, that's what, you know, thank you for pointing that out. Because
how much worse might things be if it hadn't stayed nonviolent?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. You know, one thing it is amazing that all these years, it's not like the opposition is killing the security forces. It's the other way around, along with private actors. Private security forces that kill the opposition with impunity. I want to underscore that the impunity rate is somewhere around 95%, which means that pretty much anybody can kill anybody they want and nothing's going to happen to them, including skyrocketing domestic violence. The so-called femicides or killings of women have shot up, as well as killings of men and of children. It's an interesting question because there's a lot of, you know, veterans of the 1980s. I mean, Honduras lived through the 1980s and didn't have the armed struggle that Central America and Nicaragua and Guatemala did, but there were certainly people that were involved in those movements. But they also saw how quickly a lot of people can die once you take up armed struggle. And so it's interesting that armed struggle has not been on the table since the coup, but that also means that, you know, then how do you have another strategy? I mean, people had the first 2 years was sort of insurrection in the streets strategy, a peaceful insurrection protest in the street strategy for 2 years. And then in a complicated process, the opposition split into people coming out of social movements that wanted to continue to build a base from low and those that wanted to form electoral party. And that's with Libre, the in many ways successful political party, came out of those who wanted to pursue an electoral path. But what are you supposed to do now? I mean, the election was stolen. The opposition party is just blocked from even acting in Congress, and the other right-wing party votes with the ruling party. The ruling party controls the apparatus in the Congress. It's not like you can like write a letter to your Congress member and they'll do what you want. The Juan Orlando controls the Attorney General's office. He controls all the Supreme Court. He controls the Congress, and he controls the police and the military. And the military are all over the streets. There's 4,000 military patrolling the streets with real and killing people. So it's like, where is the political process there? What's amazing is people still demonstrate on January 27th. There's going to be big demonstrations. It's the anniversary, first anniversary of Juan Orlando's illegal second inauguration from a year ago.
Just about 1 minute left. What can people do in the United States and elsewhere around the world to help?
Well, there's something very clear-cut right now, which is the Berta Cáceres Human Rights in Honduras Act. It was first introduced three years ago. It will be introduced in the next few weeks in the new Congress by Congressman Hank Johnson, and it calls for a suspension of U.S. Security aid to Honduras until human rights abuses are addressed, and that the U.S. vote no on all multilateral development bank loans to the Honduran government, to the Honduran security forces. And, you know, we had 71 people on that last year. We have to get some of those have retired or lost their re-elections. We have to get all those people on that were on it before, get the new people on, and try to get that to actually pass the House. So everybody out there that's listening, talk to your Congress member. Ask them to support right now the Berta Cáceres, that they can act. They can, if you want to read it, it's being updated. But if you want to read it, it's at H.R. 1299 in the previous Congress. You can just Google that and ask for the test. But you can please push your Congress member, whoever they are, to support the Berta Cáceres Act and to do more to support it. That's a very easy thing people can do. In the Senate, they can ask for Berta Cáceres to act in the Senate, ask for the suspension of security aid for Honduras, and more voices in support of civil liberties in Honduras.
We'll have to leave it there. We'll post links to anything else at talknationradio.org. Our guest has been Dana Frank. The book is The Long Honduran Night: Resistance, Terror, and the United States in the Aftermath of the Coup. Dana Frank, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Oh, thanks so much for caring so much.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, media have allowed brouhaha over video of a group of high school kids in Trump hats appearing to mock a Native American elder to utterly eclipse reporting on the Indigenous People's March that was its context. Though it's not clear how much thoughtful attention the demonstration would have received anyway, corporate media's disinterest in Indigenous issues and their ahistorical, distorted view of them when they do cover them are long overdue for change. Jenny Monet is an independent reporter who writes about Indigenous rights. We'll talk with her about what's missing from big media and what it means. That's coming up, but first, a very quick look back at some recent press. As Joe Emmersberger wrote for FAIR last year, for almost 20 years, the U.S. government has been trying to overthrow Venezuela's government, and establishment media outlets have been bending over backwards to help. That project took a big step forward with the announcement by the head of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, that he was declaring himself president of Venezuela, despite the fact that the nation's actual president, Nicolas Maduro, was reelected last year. The Trump administration quickly proclaimed that it considered Guaido to be the new president of Venezuela, joined by numerous U.S. allies in the region and in Europe. There's a word for a self-proclaimed president replacing the official president of a country. It's called a coup. But U.S. media have been largely avoiding that word. An AP profile of Guaido, noted Reed Richardson, referred to his naming himself president as a standoff, a challenge, an uprising, a frontal assault on Maduro's authority, and a restoration of Venezuela's democracy, but never a coup. Other outlets use the word only in quotes from Maduro. CNN's headline was, "Maduro defiant as Venezuelan opposition leader declares himself acting president," casting the official president in the role of usurper, as the story went on to say that Guaido was recognized as legitimate. USA Today made the rather ordinary process by which Maduro became president in the first place. He was named as vice president by the former president who died in office, seem weird and somehow communist. Quote, "Maduro, 56, was hand-picked by then-socialist president Hugo Chavez to be his successor," close quote. But one of the most glaring omissions in current coverage is the role of sweeping U.S. sanctions in contributing to the economic crisis that is fueling the opposition to Maduro's government. The New York Times writes that, quote, "Citizens of what was once one of the region's wealthiest nations, endowed with plentiful oil, have starved to death and died from preventable diseases," close quote. Unmentioned is the fact that impoverishing the country was the intended result of the U.S. cutting Venezuela off from global credit markets and crippling its oil industry. There's even a mention that Trump might impose new sanctions, which might lead the alert reader to wonder why the old sanctions and their effects aren't worth talking about. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. On January 18th, thousands of people took part in the Indigenous People's March in Washington, D.C., with solidarity marches in other places around the U.S. and Canada. A political demonstration, including songs, dancing, and prayers, as well as speeches, the march sought to call attention to a range of issues affecting Native Americans, from environmental devastation to violence against women to health care to voter suppression. For corporate media, though, it somehow all became about the intervention of some Catholic schoolboys from Kentucky, and the video of that, and the other video of that. And now media are on to their favorite thing, coverage about the coverage. an opportunity to talk about the lives and rights of perhaps the most marginalized community in the country, was passed over in favor of another round of self-involved chin stroking. Indigenous people may be more visible for news media since the anti-pipeline protests at Standing Rock, since the election of the first Indigenous women to Congress ever, but the quality of media's attention is still problematic in many ways. Our next guest's work fills some of the void they leave. Independent journalist Jenny Monet writes about Indigenous rights and injustice for a range of publications. She joins us now by phone from somewhere in southern Texas. Welcome to Counterspin, Jenny Monet.
Thank you, Janine. That was a wonderful introduction into exactly what has been weighing on my mind over the past few days. So thank you for drawing some attention to this issue.
Well, let's get into it. I want to talk about some of the stories that you've been reporting, but I guess I wanted to start with your sense of the place of Indigenous stories in the media landscape. You work with legacy media and are happy, I assume, to have work in those influential spaces, but navigating those spaces as someone who is committed to getting out not just Indigenous stories, but an Indigenous voice is not necessarily straightforward. There's more work than just the work of reporting itself.
Oftentimes, Janine, it is the hardest part of my job, the negotiation of working with decision makers in elite newsrooms and brokering for the Indigenous narrative. It's a delicate balance. These are my clients we're talking about, and I need their support. I need their advocacy of my work so that the legitimacy of the Indigenous narrative is elevated in these elite spaces. And that really speaks to so much of what we're talking about here. What's happening right now with this story around Nathan Phillips and the Covington Catholic affair, you know, it's the bad journalism itself that is stripping away at this very legitimacy, because for too long, the Indigenous narrative has been steeped in otherwise what has been seen as advocacy or even unreasonable ideas. But what we saw at Standing Rock is that once people actually stop and pay attention and listen and engage these Indigenous ideologies, it's not that hard to understand.
Well, and as with other underrepresented groups, it's not just a matter of media not doing stories about Indigenous people, but of not seeing Indigenous people in stories where they belong. You know, I'm thinking about police brutality, for example. Native Americans face shocking rates of police violence. Or, as you've just reported, the government shutdown, which is having particular impacts in Indian country, right?
That's correct. I mean, there's an actual lawsuit that just has been waged by a group of tribes against the federal government, and I'm just not seeing that headline produced anywhere. There was a deliberate pivot for me to leave commercial newsrooms and go independent because advocating for the stories on the inside was seemingly futile. I only had one or two editors that I could pitch to that would routinely shoot down these stories. And in large part, I felt like that was a routine undermining of my Indigenous knowledge itself. And so on the outside, where people most often view freelancing as one of the more challenging obstacles in journalism, for me, that is certainly true, but now I can knock on several doors to try to sell these story ideas, but it's exhausting, and there's got to be a better way. The better way is that an elite publication, it is long overdue for them to establish a tribal affairs beat on a national level, and that just doesn't exist today.
Well, and when we talk about inclusion in media, sometimes there's this sense, oh, you're Black, so you want more Black stories, you know. But it's really about journalism. When you leave people out of the story, you get the story wrong.
That's right.
So, for instance, writing about voter ID laws in North Dakota and not connecting that as you did to the pipeline fight. That's an example of a missed story that really, well, can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I don't think that was anything people heard very much about.
Absolutely. So that story was one of the three that sit in a growing collection, which I call the Indigenous versions of my colonized pieces. So when I publish in mainstream or established media, the process is somewhat painful for me because there's this negotiating of having to keep certain Indigenous concepts or even historical timelines in there, and oftentimes I'm less successful in taking those stands. And so the indigenous versions of my pieces, which I post on my Medium page, are kind of the core concepts that I may have tried to fight for but lost in the battle of the cutting room floor. A story out of North Dakota and the voter ID law was central to that. The DAPL battle was a huge part in that narrative. And if you recall, what was happening also in January 2017 was President Trump coming into office and almost instantly advancing that pipeline after Obama had stalled it. And also in that legislative session, we also saw a wave of anti-protest laws being considered in the North Dakota state legislature at the time because of the No DAPL battle. So all of it is connected, and we were looking at strains of retaliation, you know, because of this protest that rattled the state, and this was a reverberation of that. And that got really buried in the actual piece.
Well, Standing Rock and the No DAPL fight showed up some of the corporate media's kind of tired tropes. I remember a New York Times article that counterposed the company building the pipeline, calling it a major step towards the U.S. is weaning itself off of foreign oil, which, no, you know. But then on the other hand, they had tribes who, quote, viewed the project as a wounding intrusion onto lands where generations of their ancestors hunted bison, gathered water, and were born and buried long before treaties and fences stamped a different order onto the plains, close quote. Besides reducing communities' concerns to feelings in this case, to me, that gets a bit of a whiff of the idea that Native Americans live in or want to live in the past, you know, or go to a time before treaties. Okay, but that's leaving out, wouldn't they maybe actually like treaties to be honored?
It's a real dusty, tired way of looking at indigenous people through a lens of the past. And if we're going to talk about treaties in the present day because they're living documents. Yeah, they may have been broken, but they still hold obligations by the federal government. That's why federally recognized tribes have their sovereign status with the federal government. It is because of those treaties. To be sure, Native Americans, just defined by case law after case law, are political identities, if you really get down to it, and it is because of those treaties.
You don't really get a sense in the press that anyone really believes that tribal nations have any sovereignty worth acknowledging, you know, that these are governments that we're talking about.
Right, because from a colonized view, they see that these tribes are wards of state based on the constitutional language, and they would be right that sovereignty in Indian country is somewhat quasi-sovereignty. Full sovereignty would mean that these tribal nations would be completely 100% self-governed and solvent. And that's just not the case. As we see right now in the government shutdown, there are several tribes which, you know, 80% of their funding is linked to the federal government when it comes to capacity in running infrastructure and education and other social service programs. But, you know, it is because of that constitutional agreement and how these treaties were framed that allowed for this kind of internal colonization to take place. And that's a mutually binding agreement. And that's the setup. That doesn't mean that these tribal nations are any less sovereign because of their relationship with the government. It is unique, and it's something that gets misconstrued and simplified because it's not written about enough.
Well, your piece, The Wall of Forgotten Natives, that ran in The Guardian about folks in an encampment near downtown Minneapolis, an extremely compelling piece. But it also, just picking up on what you've just said, it also pointed out what I think is another common problem of coverage, which is that media give you a sense that Native Americans all live in one place, all live on reservations. Mm-hmm. And that's just not true.
Three-quarters of today's Native Americans live in urban cities. When we do see stories in the established press, They're most often stem from a reservation. They most often start with some kind of romantic notion of, you know, being in a foreign land. It's treated as the work of foreign correspondents. But in fact, what we saw in the midterm election is that a lot of voter suppression laws and other obstacles around the vote were happening in border towns where large Native populations live. And that's not something new to someone like me or anybody else in Indian country. Oftentimes, what gets missed is what's most obvious to Native people.
Well, those efforts in North Dakota, in particular at voter suppression, we should note that they failed spectacularly. In fact, there was a tremendous amount of voting, was there not, in Indian country generally?
Well, and particularly in the election of Ruth Ann Buffalo, who didn't realize it at the time, but she beat out her opponent, who was the author of the voter suppression law in North Dakota. And Ruth Ann Buffalo is, I believe she's Mandan Hidatsa Narikara Nation, which is a North Dakota tribe. So it was kind of a nice added detail to her victory.
Yes, something karmic there.
Yes.
Well, another piece that you wrote for Medium, you know, you were watching history being made, you know, 230 years the Congress has had no indigenous women until Deb Haaland and Charisse Davids. And just as you are absorbing that and thinking about what that means, you get a call to talk about not that, you know.
Yes. I was so upset about that. Thank you so much for paying attention to these details because, you know, I deal with it all the time. These producers, they'll call and they want to talk about, you know, one story. And I fortunately, because I've worked in these newsrooms for 20 years, you know, just roughly 20 years, not only do I know some of the people on the inside, but I also know how it works, mm-hmm. you know, how the pitch works and what they're thinking and what they want. So I'm able to kind of persuade them to maybe switch topics. But the day that this producer called me of this cable news outlet, they wanted to talk about Elizabeth Warren because she had just announced a bid for the presidency, and they wanted to build a panel that was representative across those views, but also bring in the Native American voice to discuss the controversy around her claims to Cherokee ancestry. And I have stayed out of the Elizabeth Warren debate. I feel like it is disingenuous to Native peoples and the indigenous narrative in general, simply because Elizabeth Warren has, just like we saw in the election of President Trump, she's taking up a lot of the resources, the media resources, and doing very little in the way of returning that to indigenous peoples themselves. It's highly problematic also in that the day that I got the call for her to talk, it was the day that Deb Haaland and Charisse Davids were making history, were breaking the political glass ceiling in Congress, were walking in a place that Native women like them have never walked before. And I was very emotional over watching this historic moment happen when I got the call from the cable network producer. And I asked him to change course over the Elizabeth Warren story. And he declined. I mean, he was nice. It was a nice conversation, but I declined to go on the panel. The coverage of these women came 2-3 days later. I mean, why?
Why? Why? And you're talking about people like, in this case, Warren and the DNA taking outsized space in the media. And we know that reporters or editors may think, oh, we did a piece on the back and forth and Trump calling her Pocahontas. And, you know, we're not going to do another Indian story this week. You know, that can
mm-hmm.
really
take up
that space, you know.
We did an Indian country story this month.
But then, you know, I want to say, though, Jenny, it's not that it's an easy decision, because when a group is so underrepresented and you have an opportunity to go on TV, I think there is a pull that says, all right, it's not what I want to talk about, but I should just go on TV and be indigenous, you know, like I should just uh-huh. be in that space and do that. And it takes it's another level to say, no, it needs to, the quality of the conversation and the nature of the conversation needs to actually reflect something better.
If it's just going to be me on a panel or on a being interviewed, I think you have a lot more leeway to kind of guide the conversation in the way that, you know, one would want, regardless of the topic. But this was a panel, you know, they were going to have other people there, and the opportunity to kind of sway the conversation was just going to be very difficult. But, you know, there's often times where I'm able to because I understand that, you know, the focus on Indian country is so rare that when you do get these opportunities, you understand that there are certain points to make in that time and space. And that was the case around the North Dakota voter ID law, because what was also happening at that time were a lot of really intense legal battles that are still kind of making their way through the courts. But we were starting to see some decisions coming down that were really damaging to tribal sovereignty. The Indian Child Welfare Act case, where a Texas district court judge determined that the Indian Child Welfare Act, which is intended to keep Native children with Native families, was a race-based policy, and he shot it down. He basically took what 30 years of case law has done to embolden Native families to keep this sovereignty together and reduce Native Americans to races. And if you recall what I just said, there's plenty of case law that shows that Native people are political identities. They're not, you know, they're Native people just based on their sovereignty alone are the only group, racial group in America that has this burden of proof to prove who they are, you know, their ethnicity. And that's what separates them as political identities. And this one judge has challenged that. And so that's under appeal right now. But there were other cases that were happening too, the Wampanoag and their very federal recognition being threatened by loss of their land. And so when I went on the air to talk about the voter ID law, we all, you know, you try to use those opportunities as well to just talk about how the courts in general have this huge disconnect for the realities on the ground in Indian country and how that really impacts a lot of things. And it's just an opportunity to try to just shine as much of a light as you can in these very rare spaces that get exposure on Indian country.
Well, talking about Standing Rock, Mark Trahant, who's now at Indian Country Today, said, this is a fight about story and who gets to tell it. In a way, I guess we could say that about every issue. What needs to change? Is it changing?
What needs to change, to be quite honest, is that there needs to be some very committed research, audience research, analysis, business planning. And there needs to be a business model on why Indigenous media is not working here in the United States. When you look at other colonized countries, major countries like Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, Indigenous media is solvent. It's representative. It's remarkable that it is so undervalued and absent in America. And I want to know why. You know, when Indian Country Today folded under the Oneida Nation in the fall of 2017, there was an immediate rush to try to find a buyer. And I was mildly in those conversations saying, what's the hurry? Slow down, do a business plan, figure out how to proceed. And sure enough, the assets were given to the National Congress of American Indians, which is considered a lead advocacy organization in Indian country. And that's highly problematic because, as I mentioned before, the Indigenous narrative suffers from being seen as nothing but advocacy. And here, this main, the major brand, Indian Country Today, that even people who don't know anything about Indian country go to this news platform and think that it's a legitimate news source. And whereas people who are on the inside view it as highly censored, mm-hmm. to be frank. But there's just not been the kind of due diligence to earnestly research how an Indigenous media model could function in America, and that needs to happen.
It reminds me a little bit of union papers where, because they feel that unions are so beleaguered and under such attack, there's maybe not the desire to be as critical and as searching internally as they might be. It's seen as basically a sort of defensive measure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the majority of media in Indian country today is censored. It's owned by tribal governments or it's owned by advocacy organizations. And that helps nobody. If we want to hide behind the fact that we don't want to ruffle feathers in our tribal communities, that we've been doing that, and look at the results. So I think that there's a real immediate need for some bravery and some courage, and to really kind of push back
push back in ways that we've not seen. Because what we do know is when an investment is made to do hard investigative reporting in Indian countries, say, for instance, the New York Times did an excellent piece in 2014 over an investigation into who was then the tribal chairman, Tex Hall, of the Mandan, Hadassin, or Arikara Nation in North Dakota. It was one of the best pieces that, in my view, has come from Indian country, because it revealed a lot of corruption that exists, that was going on and existing in the tribe. And from my understanding and knowing the backstory, the industry nuts and bolts of what happened, their fact-checking was one of the most rigorous in the Times history on that piece. And that's why it held up. It's so good. And so there really needs to be a real investment. And I think that if you have nonprofit organizations or philanthropy types that listen in, really think about where the money is going in terms of supporting journalism and how it's being used. Because I think that, you know, all too often people just don't know enough about Indian country, so they just give, and they don't know what they're giving to.
Do you have any final thoughts, Jenny Monet, about reporting while Indigenous, if you want to put it that way, and ideas for reporters to pick up on stories that you'd like folks to dig into?
Well, I mean, it's a real calling to do this, and I feel like it's a higher calling, because Indigenous journalism is different than what I call settler storytelling, because the view is about colonization, and the colonization that's not something in the past. It's a continuing narrative, and that kind of view of rethinking time and space, I mean, it has the power of real enlightenment. We certainly saw people latching onto that at Standing Rock. That's what I see as what the power of the Indigenous narrative holds, is this power to really kind of shift people's societal views in ways that we've not even really even explored.
We've been speaking with Jenny Monet. You can find some of her work on her website, jennymonet.com. Jenny Monet, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch group based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
There is big trouble at both poles. From Korea, scientist Malte Stucker explains why the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the world, disrupting weather over the Northern Hemisphere. Then veteran Antarctic scientist Richard Levy tells about the double threat driving Antarctic ice into the sea to flood coastlines around the world. But first,
we are old climate veterans who have tried to do our part in every way we know how to keep our fossil fuel-addicted civilization from driving off a cliff. Are we tired? Sure. Discouraged? Absolutely. Sad? Call it brokenhearted. Are we quitting?
It might be time. Game over, friends and experts tell us. We're doomed. It's true that the news about global warming is awful. More and bigger wildfires, great swathes of drought, stronger and wetter hurricanes, floods of all kinds, feedback loops kicking in, refugees looking for safety as weather turns cruel. Destructive ways of living are skillfully protected by tangles of profit and power around the globe, and we are running out of time. The IPCC now gives the world just over a decade to cut global greenhouse gas emissions in half if we are to stop warming at only 1.5 degrees Celsius. Don't think quitting hasn't crossed our minds.
Last month, on the way from one meeting to another, we stopped along the coast to watch a red sun set through purple clouds. While parents gathered up their families, children lingered ankle deep in pink water looking out to sea. A flock of gulls flew north. Why do we keep doing this climate work? We asked each other. Maybe to our surprise, answers to the question flooded out one reason after another.
Because we are not doomed as long as we act. A world in which we do everything we can to restrain climate change barely resembles one in which we do nothing. We won't like the first world, but we might not survive in the second.
Because I want to be the kind of person who doesn't give up on important jobs. You don't do what's right because you think it might get you something. You do it because it's right. That's what integrity is, doing what you believe in, even if it won't save the world.
Because I won't walk away from the hurting world any more than I will walk away from my mother as she grows old and frail and sometimes confused. I love her and owe her and have a duty to her and admire her and enjoy her company.
Because I promised my newborn children, I will always love you. I will keep you safe. I will give you the world. I didn't mean I will give you whatever is left, scattered and torn on the table after the great cosmic going out of business sale. I said, I will give you this beautiful, life-sustaining, bird-graced world.
Because everybody knows what we have to do. It isn't as though the world is waiting for some technological breakthrough or divine revelation. We just need to stop setting carbon on fire.
Because climate change is unjust. It threatens the greatest violation of human rights the world has ever seen. But injustice is cowardly and fragile. It crumbles when people stand up for what is right.
Because we have so much to lose and so much left to save. Everything from birdsong to our own sorry souls.
Because we don't want to be free riders taking advantage of the actions, often sacrifices, of those who step up. If we avoid planetary ruin, if we find better ways to live, it will be because of the courage of those who act.
Because failing to act is worse than neutral. It's saying that this climate disruption is no big deal, exactly the message fossil fuel corporations and complicit governments want to convey. If we don't respond to the emergency, we become part of the storm itself.
Because I am wearing my dad's rubber boots. They're too big for me, but my own are old and torn. So So I'm walking in the boots he wore at the edge of all the marshes he defended until the day he died. If you're walking in the shoes of your hero, you can't exactly turn back.
Because I can't, and therefore don't have to solve the whole problem alone. I only have to help where and how I can. So many good people are in this fight with us, in governments around the world, in businesses, in states and towns and neighborhoods and churches. They are smart and experienced and empowered by a vision of a planet redeemed.
Because I believe and choose to believe that in this emergency, as in every emergency, more of us will come out to help each other than will rush in to exploit and loot.
Because despair is lonely and useless, while climate action is full of friendship, satisfaction, and glee. You get to hang out with people who care as much as you do and act with the same remorseless resolve. Taking action is the only real cure for hopelessness. It feels good and important, like you're not wasting your life on small things.
We sat on a beach log, mulling over our reasons to stay in the fight, until the stars came out and the breeze came up. Then we walked back to the car on a mossy trail through a tunnel of spruce trees. The Swainson's thrush sang and would not stop singing, even in the deepest dusk. And that also was a reason. The deep moss was a reason. So were the ancient trees. So were the children standing in the swash. We can't quit now.
You just heard from two well-known American writers and activists, Kathleen Dean Moore from Oregon State University and Sue Ellen Campbell from Colorado State. They read from their article, Why We Won't Quit the Climate Fight, as published in the Earth Island Journal, January 14, 2019. Now, to the latest science from the polls.
Radio EcoShock.
When it comes to sea level rising by feet or meters, the biggest fear is melting mountains of ice piled up on Antarctica. Recently, NASA scientist Eric Regnault told us those glaciers are melting six times faster now than in the 1950s. In another just published paper, scientists discovered the marriage of two forces making that happen. This could determine the future map of the world as disastrous sea flooding invades farmlands, cities, and whole nations. The science is challenging. It involves a 34-million-year history of Antarctic ice, tiny single-celled animals, carbon dioxide, and the astronomical place of Earth in space, all of that. Fortunately, we have the lead author, Dr. Richard Levy, here to help. Dr. Levy is a paleoclimate scientist and program leader at New Zealand's GNS Science, a government crown corporation, I believe. Levy is a veteran of scientific expeditions to Antarctica, with many papers about the coldest continent on Earth. From Wellington, New Zealand, Richard Levy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks very much for having me.
How many times have you been to Antarctica, and is there a specific base or ship used for your research?
Oh, gosh, I've been to Antarctica now 12 or 13 times, 13 seasons down there. I actually started my career through the United States Antarctic Program. So I was doing my studies, my doctorate degree at the University of Nebraska, and first went down to Antarctica from America, which is sort of strange, really, given that I'm from New Zealand. But yeah, so I've spent quite a bit of time working with the US program, but also spent some time more recently working through the New Zealand Antarctic Program based out of Scott Base. Both of them are on Ross Island. Both of those bases are not too far apart, but run by different countries and run in quite different ways, to be quite honest.
And there is a big stretch in this new paper. Why did you and Stephen Myers from University of Wisconsin-Madison need to connect those tiny creatures, which I'll call forams for short, to the astronomical position of Earth out in space?
Yes, so as you've mentioned, our research focuses on the long-term history of the Antarctic ice sheet. We want to understand when it expanded, when it grew larger than today, and when did it retreat or collapse and get smaller, and fundamentally what caused these changes. We use this knowledge of past ice sheet dynamics to improve computer models that allow us to project future change and determine likely rates and amounts of sea level rise. We're particularly interested in marine-based sectors of the Antarctic ice sheet, areas where the ice sheet sits on the ocean floor, as these regions are vulnerable to increases in ocean heat, and that's something that Eric Regnault's recent study has shown to be true, that these areas of the ice where it sits on the ground below seafloor are particularly susceptible, particularly vulnerable to changes in ocean heat. So our research is really sort of trying to take the longer-term perspective of what Dr. Regnault has observed recently. We've known for a long time that changes in the way our planet orbits the sun affects climate. The shape of our orbit changes from oval or egg-shaped to more circular and back again, and this takes place every 100,000 years, this natural cycle. We also know that the tilt or slant of the axis around which our planet spins every 24 hours changes from steep to less steep, and this happens every 40,000 years. So again, these interacting natural cycles affecting our climate. So high tilt causes more energy from the sun to reach our polar regions, and this has a huge impact on the ice that sits there. Obviously, more solar energy coming in and hitting the ice sheet will cause it to melt. Now, we've known that these changes drive the ice ages, and we've known this for a long time. Research back in the 1800s and into the early 1900s showed us that these changes actually cause our ice ages. But the details regarding exactly how these astronomical shifts affect the ice sheets, they're not really well known at all. So in our studies, Stephen Myers at the University of Wisconsin and myself and our co-authors, in our study, we examined data from ocean sediment cores. Natural chemicals preserved in the layers of ocean sediment, preserved in the shells of organisms that live in the ocean, tell us about past changes in ocean temperature and ice volume. Now, we noticed there were intervals of time when the ice sheets became much more sensitive to changes in Earth's tilt. These intervals of increased sensitivity to tilt, or what we call obliquity sensitivity, happened during times when large areas of Antarctica's ice sheet first advanced into the ocean. So the first time from all of our geological studies that we see ice sheets stepping into the ocean, expanding into the ocean, then these deep-sea chemical records of climate change become much more sensitive to changes in the tilt. So we noticed this relationship. At this time, when we noticed this increased sensitivity, proxy data tell us that atmospheric carbon dioxide levels generally range between 400 and 600 parts per million. This is pretty key because these levels are like those we have today and also very similar to those projected for the next several decades. These results suggest that changes in ocean heat around Antarctica's margin respond to changing tilt. When the ice is in the ocean, it responds to tilt. It's much more sensitive. These variations in ocean heat have a major impact on Antarctica's marine-based ice sheets. Now, we also noted that the sensitivity to ocean heat change decreased during times when CO2 dropped. Now, this is really important. So sensitivity increases when CO2, in the past, when CO2 was above 400 up to 600 parts per million. The sensitivity to ocean heat change decreased during times when CO2 dropped to pre-industrial levels, so dropped sort of down below that 300 parts per million. Sea ice grew and expanded across the Southern Ocean, so this is pretty critical. Sea ice appears to act as a buffer or a barrier to ocean dynamics. So right now, today, we have a persistent sea ice, a lot of sea ice around Antarctica, and it seems that this expanded sea ice is sort of buffering or protecting the marine-based portions of Antarctica's ice sheet from heat that would otherwise be driven up onto the continental shelf due to our relatively high tilt that we're at today. Sorry, Alex, I've just carried on talking. You probably have a few questions.
I have lots of questions from that. First of all, it's fantastic science that really you can reach into what may be microscopic organisms buried in the seabed and pull out isotopes of oxygen, basically molecules, and know from that whether ice was growing or shrinking or there at all. Is that what you were doing?
Yeah, that's right. And that's not just our research. That's a huge global effort that's been going on for a long time where people have been looking, scientists have been looking at these marine organisms, the chemistry of these marine organisms and the isotopes captured, which change as ice volume and temperature changes on Earth. So you have this long-term history acquired from deep-sea ocean sediments that tell us something about what the ice sheets were doing and something about what temperature was doing. The challenge with those sorts of records is that they're not direct archives of ice sheet variability. So you actually don't know absolutely for sure that the ice sheets were growing and advancing. You've got a pretty good clue from the changes in chemistry. But what we did was take those records from the deep ocean, run some mathematics, statistical analyses on those records, and we noted changes in patterns through the isotope record. And then we compared that directly with records from the Antarctic margin, which is sort of an area that I've, well, it is an area that I've focused most of my research on, myself and colleagues, where we actually see direct records of ice sheet advance and retreat. What we noticed was that during times of high sensitivity to changes in the tilt, they correlated or matched with times where we see evidence for ice sheet advance into the ocean. So that gave us some indication that there must be a connection between times when the ice sheet was in the ocean, connected to the ocean, and an increase in sensitivity to the tilt. So this ocean ice connectivity became apparent because we compared the deep sea records, the planktonic records of climate change with direct records of ice sheet advance and retreat.
If I go to Wikipedia and look up axial tilt or obliquity, I learn we are halfway through a 41,000-year cycle and we're heading towards decreasing tilt. And according to Wiki, that should mean a cooling phase with more Antarctic ice is in the planet's future. So, you know, a doubter would ask, why is Antarctica melting in what should be a cooling phase of the Earth's tilt?
That's right. So it's, and it's not just the tilt that causes the climate to warm and cool. It's also the shape of the orbit, or what we call eccentricity, as well as precession, which is wobble of the Earth's axis like a spinning top. All of those things interact to drive the ice ages. And so if you look at Wikipedia, I mean, it's correct. We are actually, we've passed through a point of high tilt and we're heading back towards an interval of low tilt. And so based on what we've discovered, we should be heading toward a time where changes in the Earth's tilt actually cause the ice sheets or allow the ice sheets to grow if it was just obliquity driving the climate. But what we also know is that when carbon dioxide levels go above 400 parts per million, then the oceans themselves, the average climate state on Earth, gets to the point where you can no longer maintain extensive marine-based ice sheets. So in this case, carbon dioxide essentially is going to override the cooling effect of the change in the tilt. But what we're suggesting in our research and what's really critical is that it also appears that sea ice, or the presence of sea ice, buffers the ice sheets from ocean dynamics, from the warm ocean. When you warm climate, warm the atmosphere, warm the oceans by driving CO2 up, we are likely to lose that sea ice. And because we're still in a relatively high tilt, the astronomical forcing, that climate warming driven by a relatively high tilt, will actually amplify any warming that's happening because of the CO2 increase. And so on human timescales, in terms of what we're doing today to the planet, we're suggesting you'll see an amplification of any warming because of this natural warming due to high and cooling due to low tilt. So because we're in a relatively high tilt, we're going to amplify the warming. Now, you know, if we can wait 10,000 years or so, then the change in tilt to a higher tilt so that less energy reaches the poles could actually reduce some of the warming. But that's going to happen on a very, very, very slow, long time frame. And, of course, in the meantime, CO2 is high, and we're actually jumping back millions of years to a climate we haven't experienced since 30, 35, potentially 40 million years ago.
Is your 34-million-year reconstruction of the history of Antarctic ice sheet, is that new to science, or is it a compilation of earlier work?
Oh, look, I would say it's a compilation of earlier work. We've managed to pull together a whole bunch of records in a way that no one's done that before. We've analyzed those records in a fairly unique way, and we've put essentially two people or a group of people together in a room to look at those data in a different way. So it's a unique way to look at the history, and it's a unique integration of data sets.
When I look through the long history of that polar continent, we make a surprising discovery. There was a mass extinction event in the middle Miocene period, about 14 million years ago, say. But this time the killer was not global heating, as has happened so often in past mass extinctions, but it was a rapid cooling. Can you tell us what happened?
A mass extinction. I have to say, Alex, I'm not too sure what you're talking about.
Ah, well, there's another Wikipedia gem. It talks about the middle Miocene extinction event around 14 million years ago. I'll send you the link and see if I can find out more myself.
I know there. I mean, I've just actually finished reading the book by I can't remember the name of the author. The Sixth Extinction won the Pulitzer Prize. I should remember her name, which I found quite fascinating because my colleagues and I are also very interested in drivers of large scale turnover in the biotic system, in particular the plankton in the ocean. What we do notice is that there in the Southern Ocean, this is another piece of research we've done, in the Southern Ocean, if we look at the diatoms, these marine algae that live and dominate the Southern Ocean today, there are periods where their turnover is much more rapid than at others. So we actually see increased speciation and increased extinction, and it seems to be periodic. And that actually coincides with this so-called mid-Miocene extinction event you're talking about, but we actually see it as a turnover pulse. So it's extinction and speciation. Our inference is that turnover was driven by global cooling. As CO2 dropped below a certain threshold, sea ice expanded and caused geographic stress in a way, or ecologic stress on the diatoms. And so cooling can drive these turnover events, but it wasn't a mass extinction in the sense that in Cretaceous, loss of the dinosaurs is a mass extinction. It's a perturbation in the biological system. It seems to be episodic, periodic, all the way through that sort of, at least from what we can tell, last 20 million years or so.
Well, as you've mentioned, a key factor in this time of human-induced rapid warming is the existence of sea ice around the perimeter of Antarctica. Until 2014, that sea ice seemed pretty healthy, maybe even growing. What is the state of sea ice there now?
Yeah, so it's been a bit of an anomaly, I guess, where people have looked at the Arctic and the observations indicate we're losing Arctic sea ice fairly rapidly, and the counter to that was that the Antarctic sea ice was expanding. And in fact, over the last 2 or 3 years, the satellite observations are showing us that we're rapidly losing sea ice extent in the Antarctic, and I think this year has been the same. Some of my colleagues are sea ice experts, and they're certainly concerned about the current pattern, but of course the time series is relatively short. We've only got 3 or 4 years of data to show that the Antarctic sea ice is decreasing, but certainly from our point of view, from our study, we'd be concerned. If we lose that sea ice, many things will happen, but one of them could be that the warming around the margin due to the increase in CO2, but also due to the fact that we're at a relatively high tilt or a moderate tilt, will amplify warming up onto the shelf, and that will cause marine-based ice sheets to retreat. So I guess, in a sense, from my perspective, we certainly don't want to see further loss or experience further loss of that sea ice. I don't think it would be good at all.
So a second major piece of science about Antarctica has just been published in January 2019 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Recently, I interviewed the lead author, Eric Rigneau, for Radio EcoShock. How does that paper relate to your latest work?
Yeah, well, we're all interested in understanding ice sheet dynamics, I guess, on different timescales, and Dr. Rigneau's work is critical for our understanding of what's happening today and over the recent past. Those satellite time series, those satellite data he's analyzing show us that we're losing mass, or that the Earth system is losing ice mass, that Antarctica is losing mass, and it's accelerating. And to be quite frank, that's concerning. I read that piece of work, and it's something that certainly doesn't help me sleep easier at night. Now, what we're showing again is that those patterns that Dr. Rigneau and his colleagues are observing, if you look over the long term, anytime climate warms, anytime climate warms due to CO2, due to orbital features, then the oceans tend to warm around Antarctica, and the first thing to start experiencing melt, or the first parts of the ice sheet to start experiencing melt, are those parts that sit in the ocean. They're vulnerable to changes in ocean heat, and that's certainly something that we've observed from the past. We're observing it as it happens today, and most of our computer models that are informed by these past data sets also show that those areas of marine-based ice sheet are highly vulnerable to melt, and other bits that are going to go first, and that's certainly what we're observing today.
Now, I can recall about 15 years ago talking with scientists who basically described Antarctica as an inert slab of ice that would be there for hundreds of thousands of years, and that would be the last to go. But that doesn't seem to be the case now.
No, I think that's the key outcome of all of these studies is that Antarctica seems to be way more sensitive to climate change than was previously thought. As you say, people have assumed that large chunk of ice sitting down in Antarctica is cold, inert. It feels very little from the rest of the world, but boy, we're learning that that's the opposite. I know when I was doing my studies many years ago for my doctorate, my advisor was saying, look, this ice sheet is way more sensitive, way more vulnerable than many geologists at the time were saying, and it seems that he was onto something. Before him, John Mercer from Ohio State back in the 1950s, early 60s, wrote some papers, one of which was published in Nature, saying that if we continued putting as much CO2 into the atmosphere as we were currently doing back then we'd lose West Antarctica, the marine-based ice sheets of West Antarctica, and that sea level would go up by 3 to 5 meters. And you know, he did this 50, 60 years ago. And again, what we're learning today shows that he was right.
Why isn't Antarctica warming as fast as the Arctic?
Yes, okay. So there's a feature in the Earth system called polar amplification where the polar regions tend to warm much faster than the tropics. You know, average temperature goes up by, let's say, 5 degrees. The tropics may go up by one slightly. They can't really warm that much, but the polar regions can. And the Arctic's certainly experiencing that amplification right now. We're observing it. The Antarctic has sort of delayed, and part of that could be due to the ozone hole, the cooling effect of the ozone hole. We're still really trying to understand polar dynamics, but the expectation is that at some point that amplification will kick up in the Antarctic as well. Certainly around the Antarctic Peninsula, the rates of warming are high, and as high as one might expect. But over the whole of Antarctic, you're right, it hasn't quite amplified as much as the climate models even expect. But who knows, as the ozone hole anneals or heals, maybe we'll get a sudden little kick in the system that we're not really prepared for.
Should we presume there was no ozone hole over Antarctica in the millions of years that you looked at in your records? Is it entirely a man-made phenomenon?
Yeah, I am not the expert. I certainly shouldn't be commenting on that. But, you know, if there's a fundamental principle we apply in geology called the present is the key to the past, and my understanding is that the current ozone hole has been driven by human activity, by the CFCs, but I couldn't say for sure whether there was an ozone hole in the past or not. Yeah, so I guess I assume there likely wasn't, because the thing that caused it recently, certainly we weren't around to do it millions of years ago, that far back in time, but I can't say for sure.
Okay, so you're in New Zealand. Is your country's capital, Wellington, on the list of cities under threat by rising seas if Antarctica really does release its ice?
Absolutely. I actually head up with a colleague program looking at sea level rise around New Zealand, taking the research we're doing in Antarctica, the things we're learning, and applying them, what we call downstream, to New Zealand, but also to the rest of the world. And Wellington certainly is an area that is under threat from sea level rise. In fact, if I get the numbers right, I think a 10-centimeter rise in sea level by 2100, if it was as small as that, increases our risk of flood frequency from a 1 in 100 year to an annual event. It's something like that. So small amounts of sea level rise have a big effect on Wellington. Yeah, something we all need to be thinking about and planning for adapting to.
So what is New Zealand's role in Antarctic research, and does the government fund that?
The government does fund it, yes. No, we're very lucky in New Zealand. Our government invests money to have or supports a base down in Antarctica. So New Zealand has its own base where we can from out. So New Zealand has its own base out of which we can conduct our research. We've also been fortunate in the recent times, the government's acknowledging the relevance and importance of Antarctica, and it's just invested in what they call a science research platform or a science platform. It's been directed by Dr. Nancy Bertler, and it's a real opportunity for us to take some big steps forward in our understanding of the past and future response of the Antarctic ice sheet to climate change. So we're very excited that our government recognises the value and is putting energy and effort into allowing us or enabling us to do research in Antarctica.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
From New Zealand, you're listening to Dr. Richard Levy on Radio EcoShock, and we're talking about new science about the melting of Antarctica. With all our technology, Antarctic exploration is much safer now than in the days of Scott and Amundsen and Shackleton. But when you go there, do you still get a vision of that dangerous nature that's there at the extreme end of the Earth?
Boy, I've thought about this quite a bit. Lying in a tent down in Antarctica during the middle of a storm is certainly a bit unsettling. You sort of hope your tent holds and it's not going to blow away and you go the way that Scott did. But I think I can't compare what we do today to what the early explorers put themselves through. I mean, when I leave New Zealand, I get on an aircraft and, 5.5, maybe 7 hours later, I'm in Antarctica. I've got ModCon gear, high-tech gear that's designed to keep me warm as well as be functional. Now, when Scott and Amundsen and Mawson and some of the heroic figures of previous Antarctic research or early Antarctic research and exploration are concerned, they got on a ship, had to sail off into the distance. 2 years, 3 years later, they might return, and chances are they might not. So from that point of view, I think we're very lucky today that we get to go down there. It's pretty efficient, pretty quick, and we're very well looked after. Having said that, you're out in the wild. Storms come through, accidents can happen. So you're always having to, consider where you are, work carefully, be safe. Yeah. I mean, just as anywhere else in the world, you might be out in the wilderness, paying attention to your surroundings and just taking care of yourself. Now, of course, in Antarctica, one of the benefits if you're wanting to be safe is there aren't any wild animals that you have to be too concerned about. Where I work in the mountains, there's essentially no life at all. So it's really just the weather and your colleagues doing silly things if they happen to do something silly and you have an accident. They're the two main things you have to worry about. The isolation, if you're in the deep field, sometimes you can be, 2, 3, perhaps a week away from help if the weather doesn't behave itself. So, there are certainly risks, but I think the risks are just so much smaller than back in the day when those, what I might consider fairly crazy individuals sort of booked onto these ships and headed off into the distance.
Crazy but brave. So what's next for you in research?
Boy, it's a good question. I think there's so much we still need to learn and understand about the Antarctic ice sheets. I mean, we're scratching the surface. We're learning a lot. We're certainly able to simulate using computer models the response of the ice sheet to various forcings. But we know that they're far from perfect. There's still major questions about the rates at which the marine-based ice sheets will retreat or by how much. Every time we look at the ice sheet, as Eric Brignot's research and our research shows, we learn more. And everything we learn suggests that the ice sheets, again, are different to what we previously thought. So understanding the long-term history, looking at past intervals of warmth, certainly key. One of the big projects we have on the horizon is an attempt to go much closer to the center or to where the current West Antarctic ice sheet sits on the seafloor, right at what we call the grounding zone, and actually drill a hole right next door to the West Antarctic ice sheet to see whether or not it disappeared during very recent intervals of warmth, intervals of time when climate was similar to those we're trying to achieve through the Paris agreements, if we can mitigate the carbon emissions and keep warming below 2 degrees. Is that enough? Did the West Antarctic ice sheet actually disappear anyway, even if we can keep warming below 2 degrees? We're actually not 100% sure. Data from around the world suggests that at that amount of warming, 1.5 global average, sea levels were 6 to 9 meters higher. So that sort of suggests that the ice sheets disappeared even under Paris targets. Now, whether or not that's true, at the moment we're relying very heavily on models. We want to get data from the center of the ice sheet, right where the action happens to try to say, yes, it does disappear or did disappear the last time Earth was that warm, or no, it did stick around. So I think that's probably one of the highest priority research areas for us is, what does the ice sheet do under 1.5 to 2 degrees warming scenario? Does it stick around? Does it disappear? Models suggest it's sensitive, but we want to know for sure. It's understanding what it'll do with respect to all of those people that you mentioned walking around, living around the coastal regions of Earth. I mean, they're really depending on us knowing what the Antarctic ice sheet did the last time it was 1.52 degrees warmer than present. That's the priority.
From Wellington, we've been speaking with Dr. Richard Levy, and he's with New Zealand's GNS Science, and he's the co-author of the paper Antarctic Ice Sheet Sensitivity to Obliquity, Forcing Enhanced Through Ocean Connections, as published in Nature Geoscience 2019. I'll put links to the science in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Richard, thank you for sharing your valuable Down Under time with us.
Alex, thanks very much for taking the time to call. It's been a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In the Arctic darkness of February 2018, there was an extreme heat event at the North Pole. The temperature was over 30 degrees Fahrenheit, over 17 degrees C above normal. That is part of the amplified Arctic warming that crashed the summer sea ice and started the great melt of polar glaciers. It changes everything. New science is struggling to explain why it is happening in the Arctic. Researchers from China, the U.S., and Australia worked on a breakthrough paper published last November in the journal Nature Climate Change. Here to explain the surprising findings is the lead author, Dr. Malte Stucker. In a way, Malte is representative of the global nature of climate science these days. After an education in Germany, he got his PhD at the University of Hawaii. Following a position as a NOAA Climate and Global Change postdoc fellow, he's now a research professor at the IBS Center for Climate Physics at Pusan National University, Republic of Korea. From Pusan, Korea, Malte Stucker, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you very much for the nice introduction.
Well, you have published papers on the Pacific Ocean and rice in the Philippines, but how did you get drawn into the problem of why the Arctic has become so wildly warm?
Most of my PhD work was actually focused more on the tropics, but when I moved to the University of Washington for my postdoctoral research, I worked together with a lot of polar scientists, and I got really excited about learning more about what's happening in the high latitudes, and that was when this project that we published last November was started.
It was shocking when the summer sea ice crashed in 2007, and now Siberian ports are gearing up for commercial traffic. How strange is it when the whole Arctic changes within a couple of decades?
It is certainly one of the big issues we face in a changing climate. And we've known for long that the Arctic will be one of the regions that will warm fastest in response to increasing greenhouse gases. In a way, it is a situation that's been long in the coming, but the detailed processes, what are most important for these changes in the Arctic, they've been debated for a long time, and our recent paper has helped us to understand a little better the driving forces behind these changes.
Well, yes, before we get to the conclusions of your study, there were several competing theories of why warming in the Arctic is so much greater than in the rest of the world. What was the strongest contender, would you say, before your team's paper came out?
There are many different processes that have been proposed for this amplified warming, and it depends a little bit about what we are talking about. There are certainly changes in the Arctic that are due to internal variability, and due to internal variability in the tropics that might influence how heat is transported into the Arctic. But then there are also local processes that have to do with changes in the sea ice. So once we have melt in sea ice, we can absorb more incoming radiation, so that would, because less is reflected back to space, which was hypothesized as a driving force. So there's been all these ideas around, and they certainly all play a role, but we wanted to really quantify what is most important.
I thought it was mainly ocean waters coming up from the tropics. We've seen heat maps that show hotter waters going from the Gulf Stream into the Arctic and also through the Bering Strait via Alaska. Are you fairly confident that you've ruled out oceans as the agent transferring tropical heat to the Arctic as this primary cause of amplification?
Changes in ocean currents can certainly influence local changes in temperature and sea ice, but it's not really, when we talk about the influences from the tropics that's been discussed previously, it's not so much the ocean current that we would discuss, but the fact that if the tropics warm, we change really the global circulation of the atmosphere, and you have transport of heat via the atmosphere into the Arctic region, which is a much more efficient process than changes in the ocean currents, which are much usually occurring on much slower timescales.
Well, that makes sense. So as I understand it, for the purpose of this study, your team produced a model that quadruples pre-industrial carbon dioxide. And when you run this experiment with much higher CO2, which may very well happen all too soon, what did you conclude is the main driver of Arctic amplification?
So, as you mentioned, we approached this problem by trying to really isolate the role of local radiative forcing that's coming from changes in the CO2 concentrations. And we noticed when we put increased CO2 concentrations just in the tropics, which is an idealized experiment, we didn't see much of a response in the Arctic region. So when we increase the CO2 concentrations in the subtropics and mid-latitudes, we see some pronounced warming in the Arctic that's coming from heat transport from the mid-latitudes into the Arctic. However, this warming is pretty uniform globally, and there's not this pronounced amplified warming in the Arctic. That means that the Arctic is warming much more than the rest of the globe. So we only get this amplified signal when we prescribe the CO2 concentrations locally in the Arctic, which really points that local processes in the Arctic are the main driving force. And there are several candidates then that we looked at and we isolated which of these are most important. So we found that there's this process called the lapse rate feedback, which has to do with the vertical structure of the atmosphere that's most important. But then there's other factors, for example, like the sea ice feedback, the albedo feedback, and changes in cloud that also play a role. But these are of secondary importance.
So is the atmosphere in some way creating a kind of lid that's keeping the heat in the Arctic, and that's something that doesn't happen further south?
So, yeah, that's exactly the case. So it's very interesting if you compare the tropics, the tropical atmosphere with the Arctic atmosphere, they're very different. They're very different systems. So in the tropics, we really have these deep clouds, these thunderstorm clouds that go all the way from the surface into the upper troposphere, and they're very effective at bringing heat and moisture from the lower atmosphere all the way up. So what happens is that when you have increasing CO2 concentrations in the tropics, a lot of the warming is actually happening in the upper atmosphere, not in the lower atmosphere. And because it's happening in the upper atmosphere, a lot of that energy can radiate back out into space. But if you compare that with the Arctic region, in the Arctic region, we have something what we call a very strong inversion. What that means is that we have this strong lid on the atmosphere, and air that's at the surface hardly can move up because it's very stable. So what then happens if you warm the Arctic is that that heat is really trapped near the surface, and it still tries to radiate out some of this energy into space, but because it's radiating out from the surface and not the upper atmosphere, much less efficient in doing so. And that process is something what we call this lapse rate feedback.
Well, I have to admit, at first I was a bit confused by the paper. I kind of wandered away from the real point of it, but I was wondering, where does this local carbon dioxide come from? And I know that wasn't really what you were talking about, but there are not many sources in the Arctic other than a few Russian cities and maybe aircraft flyovers. Does it matter where the carbon dioxide comes from, or do we know where it comes from?
Yeah, it can be a bit confusing. I should motivate this paper a little bit better. So, of course, CO2 concentrations in reality are well mixed throughout the atmosphere due to the storms that circle around the Earth. Usually they mix up all the gases in the atmosphere, so we have very similar concentrations across the globe. So even though you have some sources, maybe in industrialized regions where you emit more CO2, it's going to be well mixed within the atmosphere within a couple of months to a year. In our case, we just wanted to understand actually the dynamics of the coupled system. And to that, we usually have to do more idealized situations. Because in the real world, if we increase in the climate model CO2 everywhere, we see that the Arctic is warming more, but we don't know what is the driving process. So by kind of separating it out from regional changes, we can get understand the actual dynamics of the coupled system a bit better. But that's not to say that this is a realistic case. But we have confidence that the mechanisms that we find actually apply to nature, because if we look at the response in these climate models to a global increase in CO2 concentrations, first of all, it looks very similar to what we see happening in nature. So nature is actually showing this Arctic amplification, what the models predict. So this gives us confidence that the models have skill and we can trust them. And then next is, if we separate out experiments with increasing the greenhouse gases just in certain regions, and we look at the individual responses to these experiments and add them all up, actually the results look the same as the response to the global forcing. So this allows us to decompose these local changes into local processes, which is a very powerful way of understanding the climate system better.
Some Russian scientists and others in the Arctic Methane Emergency Group say methane from the seabed and from thawing permafrost under millions of Arctic ponds are contributing to Arctic heating. Did your study consider the influence of methane?
No. In our study, we only looked at one greenhouse gas, that is CO2. In reality, we have additional players like methane, as you mentioned, that are very important. But the net effect is similar. So both CO2 and methane will trap more heat in the atmosphere and contribute to a warming of the planet. Do the simulation, if we would do the simulation instead with increasing methane, it would give qualitatively the same results, but only the difference would be that methane is an even stronger greenhouse gas, so we would expect an even stronger response. So that's why we should be worried about methane emissions, because the greenhouse gas potential of this gas is even stronger than of CO2.
Based on the processes that you've looked at in this study, do you think the Arctic will continue to warm more than the rest of the world, or is there some kind of limit that it might reach and stabilize?
We are pretty confident. Like, every individual model shows that the Arctic will continue warming stronger than the rest of the planet. All the models will show that Arctic sea ice is increasing at rapid rates. So that's regrettably a future that we are facing unless we reduce emissions. However, on top of this, there's certainly also internal variability of the climate system that can give you certain years where ice would maybe increase again before it drops. So we don't expect these changes that every year is going to be another record hot year. But if you look at changes over 5 years or 10 years, we will certainly see an acceleration of the warming. And that's something the models are very consistent, and we are very confident it will happen unless there are big changes in our emissions.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from South Korea. Our guest is the research scientist Dr. Malte Stucker. He is the lead author of a new study explaining why the Arctic is warming much faster than the rest of the world. Will these study results help us understand how fast Greenland ice could melt?
Certainly, for things like the ice sheets, what's really important is how many days in the summer we stay over the melting temperature. And this accumulated effect of these warm summer days will be one of the major driving forces of melt. So we can certainly use experiments like the one we did to quantify these processes. However, we haven't looked at the specific problem in our experiment yet.
There is a secondary result from your paper which could be controversial. The paper says, quote, "Thus, reducing radiative forcing at the pole may be a more effective policy to minimize Arctic amplification than previously thought." Now, I could read that as saying that solar radiation management, like spraying sulfate aerosols in the Arctic, might be effective because of the local nature of the problem. Is that fair?
That is certainly correct. So if humans decide that they want to go ahead with radiation management, which in my personal opinion think should only be a last resort, because it's not an easy fix. The easier fix is changing our technology into a more carbon efficient society. But in case humans should decide that they want to employ radiation management, then the question is, where would you put those aerosols to have the biggest net effect? And also it depends on what you want to achieve. So are you concerned about the monsoon regions? Are you concerned about maybe weather in Europe or in Asia? So these are very complex questions that humans have to grapple with. But we just ask this very, very simple question without giving a political judgment, that in case you wanted to decrease the temperatures in the Arctic, then having radiation management by spraying aerosols in the Arctic region would be an effective way of decreasing the effect of global warming there, of local warming there. But yeah, that is not said that it's a good idea to do so.
With this new study, Malte, are we now at the point of a confident solution to the problem of Arctic amplification, or is this still a matter for scientists and competing climate models?
So one thing I need to acknowledge is that we tested this mechanism just with one climate model. It's a very good model, but we certainly would like to get more confidence by having other groups using different models to do similar experiments to see if they can confirm our results. In general, though, we are pretty confident because all other climate models give this general pattern of polar amplification. So I think that our confidence is pretty strong. However, there are certainly more things to figure out, and one of those things are the importance of changes in ocean currents that you alluded to earlier. So as the globe warms, we have likely changes in ocean currents, and how much heat is transported into the Arctic or out of the Arctic will further determine how sea ice and temperatures will change. And that's something that might be more model dependent and something that we need to look into in more detail. Especially, we might need to use higher resolution models that really can resolve those narrow currents into the Arctic that are of importance here.
While we have you here, let's touch on a couple of previous papers you co-authored. For example, many of us are worried about the planet will not be able to feed billions of humans if Earth warms beyond the tolerance of some major food crops. And your August 2018 paper suggested rice may hit that ceiling during this century in the Philippines. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. This was a project I worked together with a biologist from the University of Hawaii and a fellow climate change scientist also at the University of Washington. And we got really interested in this nexus of water, climate, energy, and food. And there's been a lot of interest in the climate community to see how these changes that we are projecting to occur, how will it affect humans on these really fundamental levels. And one of the most fundamental levels is, of course, food security. And one of the crops that is most important worldwide is rice, because it feeds most of Asia, where most of the global population lives. So just to tackle this a bit, to understand how climate variability actually can impact rice production, we decided to use the Philippines as a case study, because it's nice that we have for the Philippines, we have very good rice production data for a couple of decades now. And the Philippines has a lot of different provinces, and we have this data actually on a province level, and we have it on a quarterly, it's reported quarterly. We could really go onto the very small province level and on the small temporal level and see how it relates to climate variability that's occurring in the Pacific. And there we found that your answer really depends a lot on in which province you're located. So that really pointed out to highlight that for local policymakers, they need much better information on how larger climate signals like El Nino really affect their local county or their local province to make informed decisions on how they plan for their rice production in the coming growing season.
And again, most climate science worries about positive feedbacks, the interactions that heat the planet even more. But you participated in a paper in Nature Climate Change that found a negative feedback. Why would a warming Atlantic Ocean lead to a cooling force in the Pacific?
Oh, it's maybe not really correct to say it's a negative feedback per se, because the mechanisms we looked at is more a cyclic phenomena that occurs on timescales of 20 years, but it can easily reverse. So it's not something that will have much impact in the long-term future in response to global warming. However, it can really be important on timescales that are also important for humans for the next 10 years if you want to make policy decisions. And what we found is that one of the reasons that the Earth over the last 20 years has warmed slightly less than our models projected was that the tropical Pacific was in an anomalous cold stage. So something that's been referred to as a negative phase of the interdecadal Pacific Oscillation, which just means there's enhanced upwelling of cold ocean water in that region. And in this study, we've actually found that one of the main reasons the Pacific was enormously cold was that the Atlantic, the tropical Atlantic Ocean, has warmed over this period enormously. So as I mentioned earlier, in the tropics, we can really propagate these signals throughout the atmosphere. So when you have a warming signal in the Atlantic, we heat the atmosphere, we have air moving up, and this changes the wind pattern throughout the globe, especially around the tropics. So what this warming in the Atlantic did, it created very different winds in the Pacific Ocean, which changed the structure of the upwelling of cold waters and increased the upwelling. At the same time, it actually led to enhanced sea level rise in the Western Pacific, so impacting a lot of people locally. However, this pattern will reverse as the Pacific will warm more, and also, of course, the ocean waters that will see more influence of the increased radiative forcing due to the increasing CO2 concentrations. So eventually, everything will warm up, but there can be periods of like 10, 20 years that have very distinct patterns that look different from a uniform warming around the globe.
Well, I think this is very important because, yes, things may even out later in the century, but we have to live through the next couple of decades. And I just spoke with Dr. David Victor about their paper saying global warming will happen faster than we think. And one of the factors that they mentioned was a natural warming that might occur in the next 10 to 20 years as part of a cycle, but that will reinforce other warming factors and could really affect everything from food to the rate of sea level rise to ice melting. So, yeah, we got to get through the short term before we get to the long term.
That is true. I completely agree. And there's a lot of effort, actually, within the climate community to try to make this initialized decadal predictions by putting the information we have of what's happening below the surface in the ocean into climate models to make predictions how this will change the surface warming patterns over the next 10 years. However, this is a field that's still very in its early steps, and there's a lot of challenges to predict the climate system on these regional patterns of the climate system on these like 10-year timescales. But it's something we should really pay a lot of attention to because you're right, people live locally, and if sea level accelerates locally in one region, it has enormous impact on the local population. The same as if we have a enhanced warming in the Philippines, for example, this will affect rice production in this region enormously. And these things can have ripple effects due to the interconnected society that we live in. So it's not that just rice production affects only the people in that province, but it will affect global markets and it will have ripple effects throughout the world. And that's something we know for a long time, actually, in the climate community. We've been studying El Nino, this cyclic warming events in the Pacific, for a long time. And we see, even though it's a local phenomena that's happening near the equator in the Pacific, we see global impacts in weather and climate, and we see global impacts in markets. We see global impacts in food production. So we have these case studies we can work on to try to understand these impacts of local patterns. But, yeah, much more work has to be done to really inform regional policymakers.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. We have been talking with Dr. Malte Stucker, a research professor at the IBS Center for Climate Physics, Busan National University in the Republic of Korea. You can find links to the science we discussed in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Malte, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
We're out of time, but we won't quit the climate fight. Join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
And it was unearthly, and he kind of started to explain what was going on.
You can feel the chunk that we're on actually starting to fail a bit more. Probably hairline cracks up towards the helos there.
So does that mean we should back up?
Not yet. You could always jump over a crack. The power is just, it's unstoppable. There's no mechanical system you could really design to live through a thing like this. The forces are just stunning.
Taylor Report, CIT, 89.5 FM, and the time remaining, Phil Connon is here. We're going to chew on some matters.
Well, Phil, I want to ask you about this headline, which the Globe and Mail has been beating the drum about China for a couple of weeks now. It's more every day. Today they have an editorial that says, "For China, the rule of law is a foreign idea." Hmm. And, well, what's up with that? Why would they say that?
Well, I think it shows the, you know, this is a sober, elite newspaper. And when they write like that, a highly belligerent, subjective tone, you think maybe they're in trouble. You know, they're beating the table because they don't have a good case, I would think.
Yeah.
Part of it. Last week on the show, you know, we spoke to Stephen Gowans, and we have a foreign minister who says that this is a rule of law country, you know, and, you know, we only comport and deal with people who, like ourselves, have these high values. The number one country that we're speaking of that has these high values and embodies them is, of course, the United States. And she would agree with that, except that it came up in the Gowans interview that there are problems, for example, in the South China Sea, and they need to be worked on and resolved according to the United Nations Treaty, which was signed by 196 countries, outlining the issues of laws of the sea and then pointing towards how to resolve them, how they would have to be resolved by the signatories. But there was one country that was not a signatory. United States. Now, by the way, and even there they used invisible ink. What they did was it was signed, but it wasn't ratified. So it's one of those things where now you see it, now you don't. So it doesn't apply to them.
Yeah, so they get to accuse other countries of violating it.
Oh, yeah. They're very quick about that.
Right.
They know.
But you can't accuse them because they say, well, you know, we haven't ratified it, so we're not bound by it.
But they're not bound by it. So here we are with this little tight-lipped malarkey position that we're rule of law when the great power that we're dealing with laughs at the rule of law and says, no, the international court doesn't apply to us, never could apply to us, and therefore, you know, and defines itself, whether you're talking about American liberals, Hillary Clinton, Obama, Joe Biden, whose name is in the papers again. New York Times today is urging Joe Biden to run. And by the way, Joe, please do. We need a joke. Otherwise, it's going to be he is a master of faux pas. We want him to run. But so whether you're talking about liberals or conservatives, they all have the same position. They are an exceptional country. And I would tell Ms. Freeland, you know, that's a pirate. When a guy says that he's armed to the teeth and gives you a little shove and he says the law doesn't apply to me, that's called a pirate. That is not rule of law. And if you believe in rule of law, you better run, get your badge, and come back and arrest him, although I wouldn't recommend you try. But let's not kid ourselves, you know. I have a question apropos of this, our problem. On the weekend, the prime minister, well, last Friday, I think, said, you know, China's holding a Canadian, Mr. Kovrig, and he said they're not recognizing that he has diplomatic status. Now, that's really a troubling business because that was not their argument, number one. They had various arguments.
Right.
And so what he is, according to the book, I mean, according to information, is Mr. Kovrig had been a diplomat. Then he stops being a diplomat but remains in China, keeping all of his, I assume, phone numbers, associations, probably apartment, whatever. He goes about his business. And he goes to work for the International Crisis Group. And he writes for them. He wrote an article in Miami Herald telling China they should join the Lima Group and persecute Venezuela, for example. By the way, the article was taken down. I don't know why. But I notice nobody mentions, because you're not supposed to say it, but George Soros is the founder and promoter and impresario of the International Crisis Group. So you can be I want to ask them, you really, if that's a policy, someone can serve as a diplomat and then stop serving as a diplomat. And you guys are professionals. You can stop serving as a diplomat and take a job with the International Crisis Group, which is not in the field of diplomacy. Mr. Soros and his organization are an advocacy organization. They are not welcome, actually, in a lot of countries. Now, Canada probably thinks they should be welcome. That's all well and good. But I think most Canadians would be a little bit surprised to know that you have a career as a diplomat. At least that's what it says on the paper there. He's an information man. They say he gathered information in somewhat unorthodox ways. And then he...
Well, isn't gathering information in unorthodox ways another
what would
word
that
for
mean?
Spying?
Yeah, well, people, you know, say, yeah, it doesn't sound right. But, you know, I suppose, I'm sure he's pure as a driven snow. He's a Canadian, for crying out loud. He wouldn't do anything bad. But I can understand why... I would think Canadians would want to know, really, should we be doing that? A guy works as a diplomat and then he works for Soros. And by the way, he goes to work for Soros, and I say Soros because I assume he owns the job, I think. Well, let's call it International Crisis Group. And his job, he immediately is called a senior advisor or senior analyst. How do you get to be senior analyst? What, just overnight? There's no apprenticeship. So I can see why you might have some confusion on the part of the host government because, according to them, maybe they're wrong, but they say that, you know, foreign organizations that operate in their country register. They notify the government, we're here, and it's up to the government to say yes or no. Canada does that. Somebody says, I want to set up an operation, and Canada says, you have to register. You don't just...
And the U.S. does that. They will.
Oh, right now
they're
picking. Yeah. They're picking up Russian Americans and saying, "Oh, you're an agent of a foreign state." So, these things will happen. So, but I would really just put the idea that if you have a diplomatic corps, and then they ought not to take second jobs. If for example, he says, "Well, Chief, I've had it. I've done enough diplomatic work." Quotes, italics. Now I'm going to take a job with this organization, which is an advocacy group. I think the response from the government should be, no. We have you signed up there as a diplomat. And if you're going to withdraw, that's fine. You withdraw. But you don't now do that because you're going to be – the host government is going to think you're leveraging something. And they're going to think we're in on it. And we're not. See, we're not in – we don't think that's a good idea. We'd like to keep those two things separate. So, and the Globe and the Star and those are not helping us with this question. Shouldn't somebody at the Star write a little editorial? Should a diplomat, somebody who works in it as a diplomat, take a second job, which is an advocacy, within the same national context? They're in a foreign state. My answer is no, actually. And why don't we just shake on it and say to China, you got a point there, no hard feelings. But meanwhile, we are holding a Chinese businesswoman for the Americans because she violated an American law, not a Canadian law. And I saw on the weekend that Ms. Freeland is very concerned about, rights of women, and she takes a stand. There's a 42-year-old businesswoman. She's not a criminal. And as Jeffrey Sachs, the Harvard brilliant guy, says, look, companies that have violated U.S. Laws, et cetera, they pay fines. You don't arrest the executive of the company. I mean, unless you want to tear down a bunch of stuff, which is what the Trump administration wants to do. By the way, unless on the last minute, we have a minute? We have half a minute. We want to congratulate the president of Venezuela on his inauguration, and we're very pleased that he gave a great speech and that he, at the end of his speech, he said, Viva Mexico. And we say the same. There is a new president in Mexico, and he is not joining the Lima group. He is not going to go down the road of bothering Venezuela. And whereas the Canadian government has gone over the top, it's now a dictatorship, et cetera. Well, it's what it is, but there are dictatorships all over the world Canada never complains about. So we understand it has nothing to do with dictatorship. It has everything to do with the fact that he's running the government, holding on to Venezuela's oil and not giving it to Exxon and other people. So that's why he's in trouble. By the way, you want to talk about trouble. Why aren't we speaking out for the imprisoned former president of Brazil, probably the most popular president in Brazil's history? He's in jail. Meanwhile, there's a fascist running Brazil, and Ms. Freeland will be flying back and forth and having her tight little smile picture with him. That's not a happy picture. You've been listening to the Taylor Report. We're online, Facebook, and SoundCloud, I've heard. And Phil is on Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m., Classical Underground. And thank you, Mikhail. See you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Thomas Sines, President and General Counsel of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, who assesses President Trump's recent dead-on-arrival proposal to end the government shutdown. Isabel Guerra of the humanitarian aid group No More Deaths, who talks about her colleagues who were recently convicted on federal charges of leaving food and water for immigrants trying to cross the desert along the Arizona-Mexico border. And Isabel Nunez, professor of educational studies and director of the School of Education at Purdue University, who discusses the critical issues at the heart of the Los Angeles teachers' strike and major challenges for public education nationwide. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over a month of street protests calling for the ouster of Sudan's president, Omar al-Bashir, have taken a toll on the Khartoum regime. Al-Bashir, who rose to power in a 1989 coup, faces earlier charges in the International Criminal Court for alleged genocide in Darfur. In mid-December, a small demonstration led by school students in a town near the border with Ethiopia protested rising bread prices. Security services responded by gunning down 10 protesters, three of them children. Protests soon erupted in cities across the East African country, with calls for Bashir to resign, targeting the offices of his ruling National Congress Party and Sudan's intelligence services. In recent days, a protest outside the Royal Care International Hospital in Khartoum led to the shooting of a medical doctor and a 16-year-old boy by security forces. The extended protests have attracted new middle-class activists to oppose Bashir, who has strong backing from the military and Islamic groups. Still, Bashir can rely on foreign allies, including Saudi Arabia, Egypt, China, and the United States, who seek political stability in the Horn of Africa. The U.S. Supreme Court turned back an attempt by ExxonMobil to halt an investigation by Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, seeking to expose the oil giant's role in promoting climate change denial. ExxonMobil is now facing a series of lawsuits from other state attorneys general, seeking evidence on how the company's top executives, including former U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, reacted to the looming threat of global warming. When in 2016 Healey sought to obtain decades of internal documents concerning Exxon's response to climate change, company lawyers challenged the state's legal standing to demand the information requested. The American Prospect reports that a lawsuit launched by New York State alleges ExxonMobil engaged in a long-standing fraudulent scheme to deceive investors about the impact of climate change regulations on the company's bottom line. A brief by state lawyers claims Exxon knew its representations were not supported by the facts and were contrary to its internal business practices. State attorneys general are pursuing a legal strategy against the fossil fuel industry, similar to what states successfully used against tobacco companies over 20 years ago, when they sued cigarette manufacturers for deceptive marketing practices. Buffalo, New York, first desegregated its schools in 1976. In response to a federal desegregation order, the upstate city established a new magnet school program. The magnet schools voluntarily drew students from across the city to create racial balance in public schools. Buffalo's magnet school program became a national model in the 1980s, having reduced the city's number of racially segregated schools by more than half. But over time, racial integration progress stalled. By 2012, the Christian Science Monitor reports 70% of Buffalo's public schools were once again segregated. In the 1990s, a series of Supreme Court decisions limited the tools available for school districts to racially integrate. After Buffalo became the target of a civil rights complaint in 2014, Kreiner Cash, appointed as the city's new superintendent in 2015, worked to foster higher expectations and equity in the city's classrooms. Statistics show that African Americans who attended integrated schools in the U.S. in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s had better outcomes than those who did not, and that the benefits persisted among their children and grandchildren. But Gary Orfield, co-director of the Civil Rights Project, says that without the pressure of civil rights requirements, elementary and secondary schools are becoming more unequal. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
The longest government shutdown in U.S. history entered its second month on January 21st. The partial shutdown affecting nine federal departments and smaller agencies placed more than 380,000 federal workers on furlough and forced another 420,000 employees to work without pay. Without a viable plan in sight to negotiate a settlement of Trump's demand to Congress to allocate $5.7 billion in funding for his border wall, federal employees will have gone 4 weeks without a paycheck. The growing turmoil stemming from the shutdown can be seen most visibly at the nation's airports, where the Transportation Security Administration confirmed that the national rate of unscheduled absences today was 7.5%, compared to a 3.3% rate 1 year ago. Fewer security agents has meant longer lines for hundreds of thousands of airline passengers. In a nationally televised speech on January 20th, President Trump offered 3 years of protection from deportation for DACA recipients and tens of thousands from nations who qualify for temporary protected status, programs the president had previously unilaterally ended with an executive order. The offer was quickly rejected by House Democrats, who dismissed the deal as a compilation of several previously rejected initiatives. Your reporter spoke with Thomas Sines, president and general counsel of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, who assesses Mr. Trump's dead-on-arrival proposal to end the government shutdown.
Well, I think it's deplorable that we have now the longest partial government shutdown in our history. It's entirely the result of Donald Trump's insistence on a huge investment in an unnecessary wall at the southern border, and his refusal to engage in anything that approaches reasonable negotiations. Although he touts himself as a great negotiator, what he put on the table a few days ago is clearly a non-starter. He should have known that from the very beginning. You don't offer 3 years of temporary protection for million-plus folks in exchange for a permanent, extremely costly, and unnecessary border, to the tune of over $5 billion. That's not even close to a reasonable way to start a negotiation. So it appears that Donald Trump will continue to punish federal workers, just as he has targeted throughout his tenure, Latinos, Muslims, all immigrants, women. And he seems to have a perhaps better hidden, but now manifest dislike for federal government workers as well. I don't think there's much other explanation for his inability to understand the extreme suffering that he's imposing on so many families, simply so that he can have a monument to himself in the form of an unnecessary wall.
Democrats have said that they're willing to sit down and discuss any number of these issues, but they insist that the government should be open first, laying the groundwork, the significant groundwork, for substantive talks.
Is that something that you feel is a valid position at this point?
I think it's clearly true that these are long-term issues. The issue of protecting the Dreamers has been around for decades, a recognition widely shared that those who came here as minors were raised here, were educated here, and are ready, and indeed already are making a contribution to our economy, ought to be protected permanently. TPS, temporary protected status, has for many of the countries involved been in effect for over a decade and a half. So these are long-term problems. It certainly makes sense that we negotiate those long-term problems, not with a looming and continuing shutdown, but in the course of ordinary lawmaking at the federal level.
One concern I've heard expressed by Democrats and people opposed to the Trump-imposed shutdown is that if they were to give in to the demands of Donald Trump for funds to build or partially build his wall, that there would be no end to what they term hostage-taking in the future, that Trump would see, hey, this is a gimmick that works. We'll shut down the government. That would assist him in pressuring members of the opposite party from giving him what he wants.
I think it's a legitimate concern in the way he deals with foreign governments and the way he deals with so many others. This administration has shown a tendency toward brinksmanship, and that's really not a good way of resolving any deep-seated problem that requires wise consideration. So I am saying I share that concern about really incentivizing other forms of brinksmanship at the level of serious policymaking that's involved here.
Well, just a final question on this. What are the essential elements, in your view, of comprehensive immigration reform that this country needs?
Well, I think it does start with ensuring that we protect the over a million workers who have been contributing to our economy, and that's both DACA recipients and TPS holders, and that we protect them long term. We have to address the rest of the undocumented population, the vast majority of whom came here peacefully and contribute to our economy and our society and raise families, including U.S. citizen children. We also have to address the constitutional flaws in our existing immigration system that exist solely because immigration is an exception to so many of the laws that we all ascribe to. There is, in our current allocation scheme for lawful permanent residents, blatant facial discrimination on the basis of national origin. There are daily due process violations in our immigration courts, and now attention has been brought to those kinds of due process violations at the border. So we have to really ensure that our immigration system on a go-forward basis better reflects the constitutional values that we all ascribe to. And that begins by protecting those who are here and adopting a system for the future that has the hallmarks of fairness and due process that are so central to our constitutional scheme.
That was Thomas Sines, President and General Counsel of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Find more commentary and analysis on opposition to Trump's demand for border wall funding and the government shutdown by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On January 18th, four volunteers with the humanitarian aid group No More Deaths, No Más Muertes were convicted for several federal misdemeanor charges for leaving water, packaged snacks, cans of beans, and socks in the desert for immigrants trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border. The group operates in the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge, which encompasses more than 800,000 acres along the Arizona-Sonora border. The refuge is part of the Ajo Corridor, which extends from the border to the town of Ajo, Arizona, a desert region that has been most deadly for immigrants trying to cross into the U.S. undetected. Unlike the thousands of families who've arrived at the border in the past few years, who turn themselves in to Border Patrol agents in hopes of claiming asylum. The No More Deaths volunteers were arrested in the summer of 2017, shortly after posting a video of a Fish and Wildlife official emptying several rescue gallon containers of water onto the ground. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Isabel Guerra a volunteer with No More Deaths. Here she describes the work her group does, the unforgiving desert terrain where they provide humanitarian aid, and what's next for the volunteers, who are facing a sentence of 6 months in jail.
We'll go with a group of volunteers, Spanish speakers, folks with medical experience, and folks with experience with navigation and working out in that area, like having done volunteer work before, just familiarity with the landscape. And we'll go out, we'll hike anywhere, depending on what trails we're working with. It'll be, you know, half a mile to a mile, up to stretches of 7-8 mile hikes, carrying heavy loads of water. Most people will carry about 4 gallons of water, 4 to 6 gallons of water in their backpacks. 1 gallon of water is about 8 pounds. Yeah, we're hiking out there with quite a bit of weight in the desert sun. Essentially what crossers are hoping to find is just to go around the checkpoint station. So not only is there a border wall currently up in the major ports of entry, there's a ton of surveillance in the area and like the more proximate area to the ports of entry. But then there are checkpoints up the major highways. So folks are forced to walk around in the remote regions to get past the checkpoints where Border Patrol has stationed up on the highways. So that's 50 plus miles to 100 miles out of off of the borderline, off the line with the that border with Mexico.
So Isabel Guerra, you said 9 volunteers with No More Deaths have been arrested and 4 went to trial last week. Please tell us what happened.
They have federal misdemeanors, being littering, abandonment of property on the wildlife refuge, the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge, and trespassing on unauthorized roads. Their original dates of their offenses goes back to the summer of 2017, so it hasn't really been a recent incident. There had been a long struggle with the Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Agency, Fish and Wildlife, who governs the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge, to allow humanitarian aid to be done in the refuge. For many months, there had been like a back and forth, meeting with the supervisors at the refuge, meeting with, you know, officers, just going back and forth, having discussion about what could be done. With the Fish and Wildlife, they had said no to the humanitarian aid because the Border Patrol has beacons out in the desert, and they claim that those beacons provide enough aid for migrants walking and that there's no need for additional resources out there in the desert to prevent death.
How do the beacons work?
So the beacons are several dozen feet high. They emit a blue glowing light for, I believe, a radius of under 10 miles. And so the idea behind that is that folks can see this flashing light, are attracted to it, and then press a button for a rescue response with Border Patrol. And at that point, if you've pressed the button, the expectation is that Border Patrol will come out to your location, be able to find you and provide you with a rescue, and then you move forward in that process of deportation. However, a lot of our data of folks, just the number of times the button is pressed and the lack of response from the Border Patrol is significant. That those beacons themselves don't work, their response is really, really minimal. And then any kind of search and rescue projects that they're doing is super minimal compared to the numbers that we've been able to collect with our data of folks passing through these areas, remains that are found out in the desert. Their projects alone are not enough to address the issue of people dying out in the desert.
How many border crossers have died in recent years?
So in the year 2017, that summer when the volunteers were arrested, there were 128 known migrant deaths in Arizona. 58 were found in the area around the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge and in the Ajo Corridor. That accounts for 45% of all the human remains recovered in Arizona. So that is a really dramatic percentage of folks across the entire border are concentrated in that area. That's why our work in the Ajo Corridor specifically is super significant, because that's where the highest concentration of deaths are happening. It's a death sentence to be forced to walk through the desert. And what our organization, what we're doing, what we believe in is that no one should have to die. No one should be forced to die this way.
So those convicted on January 18th are facing 6 months in jail. Are they appealing?
So it's still a conversation with the defendants and with our organization. The plan, I believe, is to appeal and continue fighting this. However, we want to invite everyone into the discussion of how, with this case, saying that it's a criminal offense to provide food and water and aid to another human being. What does that mean for the rest of us? What are we going to be doing as we see, you know, our country moving in this direction, finding these kinds of humanitarian acts to be criminal?
That was Isabel Guerra with the group No More Deaths, a ministry of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tucson, Arizona. Learn more about the group's humanitarian aid work along the U.S. southern border by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In another sign of growing anger and militancy among U.S. educators, teachers in Los Angeles walked off their jobs for the first time in 30 years on January 14th, effectively shutting down the second largest school district in the U.S. The strike, supported by an overwhelming majority of the city's 30,000 teachers, was called to demand increased wages, smaller classroom sizes, the hiring of more support staff, including nurses, counselors, and librarians. After walking the picket line for 6 school days, LA's teachers won a tentative deal that included a 6% pay raise and caps on class sizes, the hiring of full-time nurses for every school, as well as a pledge to hire librarians for every middle and high school in the district by the fall of 2020. In the deal announced January 22nd that was quickly ratified by union members, the city and county also committed to expand programs to provide additional support services for the district's neediest students. The LA teacher strike echoed complaints about the failings of U.S. education, heard in statewide strikes and job actions in 2018 in West Virginia, Kentucky, Oklahoma, North Carolina, Colorado, and Arizona. Your reporter spoke with Isabel Nunez, professor of educational studies and director of the School of Education at Purdue University, who assesses the damage austerity budgets have done to public schools and the threat charter school privatization poses to public education.
The teacher strike in LA is part of a larger movement by teachers to stand up and defend public education. So this has been going on for a while. There are a couple of main models of teachers unions out there. One is the service-oriented union, where the idea is that the union will negotiate contracts and defend teachers on an individual basis. And it's basically the union provides service to the members. But another model, the social organizing model of teachers unions, looks at the teachers themselves as being the union. So it's the union is not the separate entity that does things for us. We are the union. And this model looks at broader issues. It's not just what's going on in the classroom. It's not just wages and working conditions, but how does what is happening in schools and what is happening in our district connect to larger issues of social justice and the role of education in a democratic society. And so, looking at that big picture, there are really frightening moves toward privatization. We have a Secretary of Education who is pretty unabashedly pro-privatization, the inroads of charter schools and charter management organizations leaves teachers with a lot of work to do. So I was really excited when Alex Caputo-Pearl and the progressive caucus that he's a part of came into power in LA. And I thought this might happen, that the LA teachers might join the rest of the movements in the country around defending public education.
As you discussed in your article, there have been statewide teacher strikes in 2018 in West Virginia, Kentucky, Oklahoma, North Carolina, Colorado, and Arizona. Tell us about the environment in terms of austerity that teachers and students have experienced with a lot less resources flowing from state governments to schools across the country.
There has been a marked disinvestment in public education, both at the K-12 level and in higher education also. And interestingly, many of those wildcat strikes were in very red states, right? Some in right-to-work states where the ability of teachers' unions to collectively bargain was limited, but teachers still stood in solidarity and took tremendous risks to their jobs and perhaps to their reputations and the opinions of their neighbors, right, to defend public education. So that was very exciting to see how many teachers, even in a very conservative political climate, were willing to stand up. In Chicago and in LA, it's a little bit different. It's Chicago and LA are both pretty pretty blue, pretty democratic, but the forces of privatization are still strong. It's been a really bipartisan effort to weaken public schools. What was passed under the Race to the Top legislation has been so destructive in terms of value added in teacher evaluation, which means that that teachers' evaluations are heavily dependent on students' test scores, which those are more impacted by parental income than anything else. So it just punishes the teachers who choose to work with the highest need populations, as well as being statistically indefensible. It's been both a Democratic and Republican project to dismantle public education, and so it's exciting to me to see teachers in both more progressive and conservative areas standing in solidarity together.
That was Isabel Nunez, professor of educational studies and director of the School of Education at Purdue University. She's co-author of the book titled Worth Striking For: Why Education Policy is Every Teacher's Concern, Lessons from Chicago. Learn more about the battle to preserve and advance public education by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KMEC in Ukiah, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Operation Shutdown. As government offices shut their doors and government workers continue to work despite no paychecks for weeks, the U.S. government shutdown marches on. If ever there was an opportunity to show the sharp divisions between workers and the wealthy elites, here it is. Many federal workers fancy themselves as middle class. But if someone is one paycheck away from disaster, he or she is actually working class. The high end, perhaps, but still working class. The present cabinet is composed of men who are among the wealthiest in history. Remember former Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson, who briefly warmed the seat of Secretary of State? He led Exxon during its most lucrative era in modern history. In mid-2014, ExxonMobil had a market value of over $422 billion. Do you think men like this know about rent, groceries, or gas prices? Do you think Trump does? The truth is, they live in mostly different worlds. Federal workers are pawns on the chessboard of life. They work for the government, yes, but the present government doesn't work for them. They are ultimately expendable. The rich have purchased their government, and it works for them. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Dedication to the civil rights movement and his martyrdom in April 1968 made him a global icon of social justice. Born in 1929, if he were not martyred, he would be enjoying his 90th year of life. But he was martyred, and too, he was considered an enemy of the state. Why? Because he didn't end his struggle at the March on Washington and his I Have a Dream speech. Wasn't his last word on the subject. His speech at Riverside Church, where he denounced the Vietnam War, capitalism, militarism, and racism, marked him as a man now walking the road of radicalism, albeit almost alone. He was denounced by major media and betrayed by his so-called allies in the civil rights movement, like the NAACP. And because U.S. government and police considered him a communist, he was killed on April 4, 1968, a year to the date of his Riverside speech. He was on the side of the poor, the oppressed, the damned, the wretched of the earth. He was against materialism, greed, and capitalism. If you want to remember him, but as he really was an enemy of the state from imprisoned nation. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
It's Organization Movement Central.
Gotcha.
And you are the man of the hour right now. I'm going to pass you over to Robin Spencer, Dr. Robin Spencer, who's the host tonight.
Very well. Thank you.
Wonderful. Welcome, Mumia. We're so happy to hear from you this afternoon.
Thank you, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. I want to describe the scene maybe since you're not here with us yet.
Okay.
There are about 80 of us in here from all walks of life. We have come in from the cold New York winter on a frigid day with Donald Trump as president of these United States. And we are here to hear more about your freedom, dreams, and the struggle and how we can support you.
Excellent, excellent. Well, what you're doing today, despite this Arctic cold we're experiencing, it's a damn good beginning because... the solution to repression and oppression is organization and movement building. Those are the only real solutions. When people get together and organize and fight, that's when change happens. When they don't do that is when repression happens. You know, we need to think about this in fundamental ways, about force and counterforce, about repression and struggle against that. And I think it was Frederick Douglass who said, without struggle, there is no progress.
Yes, right on, right on.
So, you know, you're doing what you're doing, and you're doing what needs to be done, because it seems to me that most of the people here are activists and organizers. Well, I'm going to, again, quote a great... Black leader. This is Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, who wrote the book Black Power. Organize, organize, organize. He ended every speech he ever gave in his adulthood with those words, and we must learn from that.
Definitely. Well, we're here today in particular to find out about new developments in your case. We want to be informed so we can take the word back to the movements and communities that we're accountable for. How are you feeling now with the potential of the doors opening?
Well, you know, I think I probably joked about this, but it's not a joke because, damn it, it ain't funny. But this was probably the first time I've been before a state judge of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania who was not paid by the FOP. And that means something, you know. I want that to settle in your minds. He was a former life member of the FOP. And we know from the appeals from his decisions that we went to the Supreme Court and we complained about a man who would be later the Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and we said he should remove himself and recuse himself, he said, well, if taking money from the FOP disqualified me from sitting here, then what about all the justices around me? At least four of them took money from the FOP, including me. I didn't know that until he wrote that in his opinion, rejecting our call. But I was like, damn, well, maybe all of you need to remove yourself.
Yes.
But all of them were paid by the FOP because they said so. So, you know, the newest developments come from a judge who hears and did and decided based on what he heard, as opposed to the kind of money that was being slipped into his pocket. Mm-hmm. And that's a new development.
Definitely. And I want to say that we are in a room full of people who are long-distance runners in the movement to free political prisoners and prisoners of war. So I want to acknowledge Pam Africa from the Concerned Friends and Family of Mumia, Johanna Fernandez.
That's right.
We have Glenn Ford with us today, who's going to bring the word of radical journalism to us. I also want to acknowledge
that
we are in the People's Forum. We are in the People's Forum. So we have one of the organizers of this space, Manolo, to come and share some words with you and welcome you. Dr. Joseph Harris wants you to know that he's in the house.
Dr. Joseph Harris, yes, right. Well, Pam Africa, Glenn Ford, all of you, welcome. Thank you. On the move.
Well, we Herb Boyd. Right. Well, we want to just say to Mumia and to all our comrades who are here today that doing this activity today is part of the long-term commitment that the People's Forum and our collective have to the liberation of our people. We're not doing this because we just want to defend Mumia. We do this because we believe in the same liberation process that Mumia believes in. And this is not a struggle for today, but a struggle for all our lives. When Mumia is out, we will be happy to receive him here for the ongoing party, but also for the continuing work to transforming our society. Thank you for having us here.
Thank you. Thank
well
you.
Said, sir. Well said. Thank you. You're absolutely correct. The movement is, you know, a lifetime movement. I don't think I really understood that when I was 15 and in the Black Panther Party, but, you know, life presents opportunities to us, and life teaches us. And, you know, to quote the late Kilu Niasha, a Black Panther from New Haven who transplanted to California and spent her most of her life in California, freedom is a constant struggle.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slade Show.
Welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show. I'm really glad to be here today. I'm just feeling like I just want to run through everything. And
Maybe it's because I had a little bit of a cold for 4 or 5 days, but now I feel really good. Anyway, we have a packed show, so I'll just get right into it. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to a piece from Bob Avakian, which is about, it's called More Postcards of the Hanging, the Horrors Perpetrated Against Women Under the System. And it's from BA Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, a speech given by Avakian in the fall of 2012. Check this out. You really need to check this out. Listen to it. Think about it and act based on what you think about it. All right. And it's all tied in with the whole thing that's going on. All right. So we'll be taking a listen to that. Before that, we're going to be talking with Paige Korich-Klein, who's from No More Deaths. She's talking about the first in a series of trials of activists with No More Deaths. The activists are accused of various misdemeanors for leaving water, food, socks, and blankets in the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge on the southern border between Arizona and Sonora, Mexico. So stay tuned for that. It's a really good interview. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing to the show someone that I just came across when I was like, I was looking for what would be the, what I felt was an appropriate topic for today and an appropriately strong and critically true analysis of what's going on in the world, in particular in relation to the relationship between Mexico, and quite frankly, even going all the way south, we have the thing all the way down to Honduras. And what's the relationship between that and what's happened? What happened in history around all this? And the person we're going to be speaking to is Alvaro Huerta, and he is an assistant professor of urban and regional planning and ethnic and women's studies at Cal State Polytechnic University in Pomona. Alvaro, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure, man. Sure. Let's jump into this because there's so much to ask you.
Right.
You open up the piece that I read recently by stating that the historical ties, and you think about this. This is Trump is out there and he's telling people every day, every minute, he's telling people the Mexicans, the people south of Mexico, they're coming up here. They're riding these wild horses to come in and charge. It's the whole thing. It's the Cossacks coming in and they're trying to storm the borders. And with the Cossacks comes all the thieves and the drug dealers. And this is what he's painting as what's going on. Now, you open up your piece by stating that the historical ties of Mexican immigrants to the U.S. are a very different story. They're very different than the ties of other immigrant groups, especially white people. Let's talk about actually that beginning, okay?
Right. Yeah, I mean, Trump acts like Pancho Villa's coming back and invading the United States once again. It's just absurd. I mean, the Mexican people go back thousands of years to this land. I'm talking more the indigenous aspect or the DNA of Mexicans is primarily indigenous. So we go back thousands of years. So this idea that we're foreigners or strangers or invaders is just absurd.
Mm-hmm. But it's actually, but it is out there in a really big way, which is really, and especially in terms of when you look at what's happening today, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but the whole idea that the lives and the well-being and the comfort of white people in particular are being, it's sort of, they're somehow being threatened by people who are, one, portrayed as, again, yes, as the horde coming north. And one of the things you speak about is it even goes so far as – I wasn't aware of this guy until you actually mentioned. Then I looked up some of the stuff that he's written. But Samuel P. Huntington of Harvard, and I thought that was a fairly heavy statement that he's made in terms of – he had this article called The Hispanic Threat, and he talked about – he claimed that Latinas and Latinos in general and individuals of Mexican origin in particular – represented an existential threat to the U.S. Let's talk about that. And how widespread is that?
Right. Yeah, it's very deep. I mean, when you look at someone like Trump, he's very inarticulate and he can't really take him seriously. But this doesn't just apply to people like Trump. I mean, you have some of the most prestigious intellectuals in the world coming from Harvard arguing that Mexicans are genetically inferior to whites. And it has to do with them being indigenous. But he also brings up this idea of religion, that Catholicism is inferior to Protestantism. And all these ideas that pit one group against the other. And it's all based on this idea of eugenics, which is actually a pseudoscience. It's not really a science. That one race is inherently superior to the other. And this explains why, Europe is advanced, the United States is advanced, and Latin America and Africa, or parts of Africa or parts of Latin America, are not advanced. So this is very widespread. Some people are more articulate and more sophisticated in the way they make this argument, and they pretty much hide it. I mean, you see this in Congress and a lot of the congressional leaders, especially conservatives. They hold these beliefs, but you have a few people like King and Trump and others that are very explicit. But it's not just the far right or those that argue in a very gross way. It's also these intellectuals and others that make this argument based on the fact that whites are superior to brown and black people.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But, you know, and one of the things that came up in what you did, which I thought was really, really very, very important, very valuable, is that you looked at this. And again, I do think we have to take Trump seriously. We do have to take him seriously because he's a fascist who actually runs the most powerful fascistic, you know, country in the world, government in the world, you know. And this is – and he is – you know, he started from the moment he came into power, he started talking about the threat from the bad Mexicans, the threat from the people that are coming up and peering through the wall and looking for the ways to bore their way through and to come in and savage the American people, you know, who when he says the American people, he's mainly, as everybody knows, it's sort of his catchphrase for the white people. And, you know, he brings this in. And I thought one of the things you spoke to very well in your piece was that basically for all this time that Trump has been saying this, there's a whole other history that many people don't even know about. And it's a history that tells a very different story. Let's talk about that phenomenon, and then the story. What is the actual story? What's the truth about what's going on there?
The barbarians at the gate, the Mexicans are invaders. And now Trump is throwing in people from Honduras and El Salvador and places like that, and Haiti. But really, if you think about it, the true invaders in history in terms of taking land and conquering people, have pretty much been European countries and countries like the United States. And this is history. This is not radical history. This is not like communist history. This is just history. It's portrayed as in high school and in K-12 as something that's neutral, like when you say like the U.S.-Mexico War, makes it seem like it was just both parties were involved and it was a neutral war between two nations. It wasn't that. It was an imperialist war between the United States invading another country, Mexico. So the true invaders, if we're talking about invaders in terms of history, really the true invaders of the United States are invading or have invaded another country, which is Mexico. And it's not just we're not just talking about 1848 when they took most of the land. Earlier, the United States or residents of the United States or white citizens started to settle into what's now known as Texas, where they were allowed to settle by the Mexican government as long as they practiced the religion, as long as they married, you know, within the culture and they embraced the culture, and as long as they didn't bring in slavery, because by then Mexico had abolished slavery. So that was key. So, but once they settled, the people that settled, the white Americans that settled at the time, their intentions weren't to integrate, to acculturate to Mexican culture. Their intentions were to take the land. So eventually in 1836, you know, they took Texas, and then later, you know, they took the rest of the country, half of Mexican country. So when we're talking about invaders, then what I argue in this article is, as somebody studies history, is the real invaders have been the United States government in taking land from Mexican people, taking land from Puerto Ricans, taking land from Hawaiians. Right. So, you know, we have to put it in historical context if we're going to use that language. Mm-hmm. So this is something I think that Americans in general and are, you know, ahistorical. They pretty much operate in terms of like today, but they don't really understand because they're not taught this history. What are some of the consequences of historical past, like slavery and things of that nature, and how that reality or those facts are still manifested today?
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Alvaro Huerta. He's an assistant professor of urban and regional planning and ethnic and women's studies at Cal State Polytechnic University in Pomona. And we're talking about, what's going on when Trump actually talks about the Mexicans and the people south of Mexico coming and storming the borders, trying to rape and pillage everything that's good in the world, which is, in their view, America, and actually the real truth about who did what to who. Now, Avar, tell me this. You know, it's interesting because in a lot of ways what you talk about in the article that you wrote, you talk about the impact of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and at the seizure of Texas opening the door for a major land grab, which you began to talk about. And this had a huge impact on Mexico. It wasn't just that they stole this land and they set it up and too bad, you know, don't cry your crocodile tears to us. We did it fair and square. In fact, it actually had a major impact on Mexico and the Mexican people. Let's talk about that.
The treaty itself allowed for people that settled, for the Mexicans that decided to settle and what became the United States, they were given full rights, and they were allowed to keep their land, and they were allowed to practice their religion, their language, and their culture, and so on and so forth. But shortly thereafter, the United States, just like they did with Native Americans, you know, they have a practice of breaking treaties, so they broke the treaty. And the Congress ratified the treaty, and they pretty much took away a lot of these rights. And then through the courts and through other illegal means and violence, white American citizens and through the state, through the support of the state, started to take the land away from the Mexicans that had owned it prior to the occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So you see that the way the United States has dealt with the Mexican people from day one has been very hostile. And in reality, the Mexican people, and this has to do a lot with the Catholic Church. I mean, I'm an atheist, so I'm saying this objectively, but I was also born a Catholic. I was raised a Catholic. But the Catholic Church has indoctrinated or taught or teaches people to be docile and to be humble and to take this misery and where you'll be rewarded in heaven. Now, I say this because the Mexican people in general are very docile, very humble, are very... They don't have a tradition. I mean, you have elements, like all people, of invading countries, of doing these type of things that they're being accused of, you know, because of the way they've been brought up and they've been raised and so on and so forth, right? So they're being painted or were being painted as this menace when in reality, you know, we've been the ones that have been victimized throughout history and continue to be victimized and blamed for America's problems.
Mm-hmm. You know,
now, the white working class in this country has problems, but those problems are not problems that we created. You know, those are problems that are based on capitalism and government neglect. But it's easy for those in power to say, oh, it's not us. It's those brown people over there that are causing your misery.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get a job because Pablo here is taking your job and so on and so forth. Now, those people themselves, they bought into this lie and they bought into this myth for their own benefit as well, because they don't want to be held accountable or they lack personal responsibility. So instead of taking personal responsibility that I'm poor because I didn't go to college, they blame Pablo and they blame my mom and they blame my dad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for me, this is unacceptable. And if Americans want to be, especially conservatives, if they believe in individual responsibility and accountability and the Protestant work ethic, then don't be crying about somebody outworking you.
Well, but the big thing, too, though, I mean, I think it's really important that people understand this. And I know a lot of people have, if anything, a minimal understanding of the history of Mexico
right.
and its relationship with the U.S., a lot of people in this country. And the problem is that all the stuff that you've been talking about, the fact that the Mexicans who decided to stay in the U.S. after that territory was seized by the U.S., they decided to stay in there and they were supposedly protected by the treaties you were talking about, but they eventually ended up losing everything. And then you
right.
then you think about this, you think about what's going on today, and you think about the kind of, you know, the way things are presented so that, you know, when you think about Trump today beating these xenophobic drums about Mexicans and others coming to the U.S. to rape, pillage, and steal, you really have to remember who did what to who. He's painting this picture
right.
of all these people from Honduras on up, and especially at the Mexican border, they're trying to sneak in, they're trying to take everything that's really good and pure and everything else. And the reality is that the U.S. did exactly that to the Mexican people.
Right. It's actually the opposite. It's like the bully, you know, picking on the little guy and then going home and blaming, you know, the little guy for his actions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at the gangs with MS-13 and the gangs that are ravaged. There are menace in Central America and Mexico and places like that. But MS-13 was founded here in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, in the MacArthur Park area. So the United States exported the gangs to Central America, right? Oh, when we're talking about drug addiction, there is a problem with drug addiction and the drug lords and the gangs and Mexico throughout Latin America. But that wouldn't exist if there wasn't a high demand for drugs here. So it's like it's a supply and demand. So, yes, there is a problem, but also we have to look inward, and Americans have to take that responsibility to say, you know, if we did, if there wasn't a large demand for it, there wouldn't be the supply wouldn't be there. So it's very easy and convenient to blame the other.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is that the United States has major problems, and they have to look in themselves and take on that responsibility and accountability versus trying to blame someone else for what they caused.
Yeah, and we're going to have to wrap this up, but I also want to add that actually people have to dig into, and one of the reasons why I really wanted you on the show today is because of the truth that you told about the relationship between Mexico and the U.S. historically and currently, and I think it's really important. It's important that people know that, hello, folks, you're being lied to, left, right, up, down, you know. This is, and it's not just Trump. It goes all the way back. We can trace it all the way back to the beginning. But we are going
to... not just Trump. I mean, the wall has nothing to do with Trump. It has to do with the fear and the racism against brown people in this country. And the fact of the matter is that brown people, Mexican people, Central Americans, African Americans, you know, people from African Haiti, they have a strong work ethic, beautiful people, beautiful culture, and they should be embraced instead of rejected and vilified.
All right. On that note, we are going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you. I'll come back for a part two.
All right, great. I'll look forward to it. All right,
okay,
thanks, Alvaro. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Dr. Alvaro Huerta, an assistant professor of urban and regional planning and ethnic and women's studies at Cal State Polytechnic University in Pomona. And we've been talking about the reality of who's threatening who. They accused the various immigrant people of coming in and trying to steal jobs and steal things. And actually, the true story, as we just heard, is those people were settled on places like Texas, Arizona, other places, and the U.S. came and took all of their land and all that they had. Wow, imagine that. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
There's a land, so I've been told. Every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. And when it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson you must learn. You will lose more than you'll ever hope to find.
All right, welcome back. That was Bob Avakian, and he was performing that song along with Outer National, Across the Borderline. Okay, and it's a really very moving song, and I thought it was very important to play that in relation to what's going on in the world today. And I thought it was also important to play it, well, just for what it brings out. Okay, I think it's extremely important. I thought it was very, very beautiful that Avakian and Outer National did that, and it means something in the world, folks. Let's not get all, you know, hide it up and say, you know, act like we don't have to have beautiful culture, powerful culture. We have to have things that actually express good things for people, all right, as well as the truth about what the hell is going on in the world. All right, you know, just last night I had a chance to talk with Paige Courage Klein, who was representing from No More Deaths, and she was representing some of the people that have been put on trial. There's been 9 people facing charges, 8 of them facing misdemeanor charges, 1 facing felony charges. We were talking about the first of 3 trials, and our conversation took place just as the trial was ending. Since our interview, the federal magistrate conducting the trial found all 4 defendants guilty, and sentencing will be scheduled within the next 10 days. This is an outrageous verdict against people whose actions have had one purpose: to save the lives of migrants in the face of government policies meant to kill those crossing the southern border. If you want to support the work of No More Deaths or just find out more about it, follow the trials and share all of this with your friends, go to nomoredeaths.org. Once again, that is nomoredeaths.org. You can also follow them on Twitter at No More Deaths. So let's get into the interview with Paige Courage Klein. No More Deaths is a humanitarian organization based in southern Arizona. Since 2008, they have been an official ministry of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tucson. The mission of No More Deaths is to end death and suffering in the Mexico-U.S. borderlands through people of conscience working openly and in community to uphold fundamental human rights. Members of No More Deaths were charged with federal crimes last year after attempting to deliver food, water, and other supplies to migrants on the Arizona side of the Sonoran Desert in the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge. The trial is the first of a series of legal proceedings against humanitarian aid activists helping migrants and refugees on the southern frontier. And the names of the four No More Deaths volunteers that are on trial right now are Natalie Hoffman, Una Holcomb, Madeline Hoos, and Zachila Orozco McCormick. And joining us to talk about all this right now is Paige Kowrich-Klein. Paige, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's jump into this. Can you fill out what the mission of No More Deaths is, and just to give people a better overall understanding of the organization and its mission?
Yeah, so I'm a volunteer with No More Deaths. It's a mainly volunteer-run humanitarian aid group based in southern Arizona, and our mission is to end death and suffering on the U.S.-Mexico border, mostly focused on migrant deaths and disappearances. We are most well known for putting out food and water drops on known migrant trails in areas where people have died in the past. And then we have a series of other projects, such as abuse documentation, kind of tracking Border Patrol abuses. And then also we do some legal workshops here in Tucson. And we have a search and rescue team that does non-law enforcement search and rescue of missing migrants.
Now, just so people get a, and this is interesting because I didn't realize this was part of what you do, but just so people get a sense of like what life is like for people trying to come to this country from other countries, when you talk about abuse documentation, what is it that you're talking about there in terms of the abuse that they face?
We actually mostly just do documentation of abuses on the U.S. side at the hands of Border Patrol. So we have a report series that we've been publishing over the past few years called Disappeared, and it's focused on just the crisis of death and disappearance in the borderlands. And so part one was focused on deadly enforcement practices by Border Patrol, looking at the way that Border Patrol agents will chase and scatter groups of migrants into remote areas where they then become disoriented, lost, and sometimes die. Part two was called Interference with Humanitarian Aid. A lot of people are familiar with a video of Border Patrol agents destroying water gallons, but we released that as well as some analysis of logbook data that we had from our water drops. And then part three, which hasn't actually come out yet, we're still doing a bunch of analysis, is about emergency non-response. So looking at just the lack of search and rescue done by law enforcement and local authorities in southern Arizona, we've seen that there's a very compromised response when somebody who calls 911 speaks Spanish and is presumed to be a border crosser. They often don't have somebody to look for them. So we're documenting a discriminatory emergency response practice.
Mm-hmm. Now, over the last year, the organization has been hit pretty hard by the federal government, criminally prosecuted for doing and carrying out this mission. And the first four people are currently on trial. Can you explain to people what they're on trial for and what has happened so far?
Yes, right now it's the first trial for our Cabeza 9 defendants. So nine of our volunteers in the summer of 2017 were stopped. It was actually three different incidences where they were stopped while doing humanitarian aid on the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge, which is an area that we know to be kind of a hotspot for migrant deaths and disappearances. In 2014, we started recovering a lot of human remains and finding people that had died. And we also have gotten a lot of missing persons reports from that area of people that we've gone out and looked for but haven't found. So these volunteers were out putting out food and water in one of the hottest, deadliest summers on record. And they actually, none of them were cited or charged in the field. They were sent letters or had Fish and Wildlife come and knock on their door in Bellingham, Washington, and New Orleans, and Minneapolis. All these volunteers kind of live all over the country, and they were given their charging papers like months after the fact. And so this is the first of those trials. And it actually just ended Thursday evening was the end of the trial. So we're currently waiting for a verdict from the judge.
And what would people be facing?
These four defendants are part of the Cabeza 9. It's nine of our volunteers that are facing misdemeanor charges for putting out food and water on the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge, which is it's a wildlife refuge, but a lot of it is a wilderness area. And it's an area that we started going to in 2014 And we started hiking into some of these more remote areas. We started finding a lot of people who had died and realized that when we looked at maps of known migrant deaths, those areas were blank, but it was just because nobody had gotten that far into the wilderness to find these folks who had passed. So we started really ramping up our presence there and putting out more food and water. And the refuge itself responded by changing their permit application language to specifically ban leaving food, water, water containers, blankets, medical supplies, and clothing, which was directly targeted at our volunteer base. And so now we have 9 defendants, and the first 4 of them just finished up trial on Thursday afternoon. There's 4 of them, and one has a charge that's operating a motor vehicle in a wilderness area, and then the rest of them have entering a wildlife refuge without a permit and abandonment of property. Just to clarify on the operating a motor vehicle in a wilderness area, our volunteers were driving on a road, but it was an administrative road that is not open to the public. But it's the only road access to get into some of these really key areas where we've documented a literal trail of death, where there's a line of people who year after year are found dead in the same area. And the only way to really get in there when it's hot is to drive on this road.
Mm. Now, what you're talking about is, I mean, it's very moving and it's very, you know, it's also enraging to think that people are being prosecuted for this. The members of No More Deaths, you guys you're being prosecuted for doing whatever you can to stop the suffering and death of large numbers of immigrant people. And their only crime is trying to make their way into a place where they might be able to make a living. They might be able to stay alive, feed their families back home, whatever. When you talk about what could happen to the people, basically to the No More Deaths people, what is it that they would be facing in terms of the punishment?
So these volunteers are facing up to 6 months in jail. That's mm-hmm. the maximum penalty. And I think, I don't know if it's $5,000 or $10,000 in fines, but it's some pretty hefty fines as well.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear on that because I think it's important that people know that this is not going to be just a slap on the hand, that they're going after this. And in a sense, they also, which we can talk about a little bit later, but they're also not just going after these individuals, but really looking to break the back of the organization itself.
Yeah, definitely. I think since we released the report, Interference with Humanitarian Aid, it seems, and since Trump has come into office, it seems like there's been a pretty intense backlash towards our organization. And really, I think it comes at a time where there's nationwide really a trend of kind of ramping up the war against immigrants and the undocumented community, as well as really targeting organizers who are working for migrant justice. I do think it's significant that our organization is most of our membership are people who come from pretty high levels of privilege. And so it is definitely notable that the government is now kind of expanding the net and targeting people with privilege, which I think historically has really been an indicator of, you know, a more authoritarian regime. While we don't really want to center ourselves in the story because we know that the people getting the brunt of it are the folks crossing the border, it definitely does feel significant that our organization is being targeted.
Yeah, and it's something I want to get into, too, because it's, look, you know, there's a need for many more people like your organization and like you guys to actually be out there doing this kind of stuff. We're talking about the actual life and death of immigrant people, you know, people who are simply trying to get a way to stay alive, to feed their families back home, whatever, and they die on a pathway that they never should have been on in the first place if there had been any justice in the world, but that they are on, and then they're left out there to die, and the people that are trying to actually help them make it through are then prosecuted and threatened with jail and massive fines.
Yeah, you're preaching to the choir.
Good. This is the first of the trials, as you said, that the government has threatened. And in addition to another group of people also facing minor charges, one person, Dr. Scott Warren, is also facing a felony charge and the possibility of 20 years in jail. What's happening there?
So Scott is also actually a part of the Cabeza 9. So he will be going on trial February 25th. For his misdemeanor charges. I think he actually just has the operating a motor vehicle in wilderness and abandonment of property are his charges there. But he'll be facing those. Those are the first trials that he'll go to. And his felony case was actually just scheduled a few days ago. It's going to happen in late May and early June. So we're still kind of in the motions time period of his trial and process. But eventually this summer, we're going to have the actual trial happen. So we're kind of holding our breath to see what happens, and we're optimistic, but we also have just seen a real shift in the way that immigration law is being enforced and practiced in this country.
The No More Deaths has been heroic in both carrying out your mission with regard to immigrants making their way through the desert and exposing the actual role of what I think can only be referred to as the fascistic border patrol in relation to the immigrants, actually condemning immigrants attempting to make it across the border territory to death by sabotaging of supplies and water and other acts. How do you look at what's being done to the immigrants now?
I mean, I think what's happening is egregious. I think it's easy to say, oh, the system's broken, we need to fix it. But I think also our immigration policy for a really long time has been race-based, has never really prioritized people's needs. It really has just kind of looked at what the economic needs of the country are and tried to kind of fit in the undocumented community wherever it can best exploit them. So it has become more egregious. I think there's more people coming up, especially coming up to cross the border because of state violence in Central America and in indigenous communities in Mexico. You know, I think the Border Patrol was not prepared and has never been prepared to deal with the humanitarian crisis that they've created. And so we're seeing just more and more egregious things like the death of children in detention, Yaceline and Felipe. And it doesn't seem like it's going to get better, and it doesn't seem like they have the resources or the ability to handle it responsibly, because that's not what they're designed to do. They're designed to enforce, hunt, catch, and deport people, and they're being put in this role of kind of first initial contact of folks who are fleeing violence, and it's completely inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with Paige Courage-Klein of No More Deaths about the ongoing trials of activists on federal charges for carrying out humanitarian work along the border where thousands of immigrants have died in the past few decades as a result of government policies meant to cause their deaths. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you as well is we're talking about all this and what was done. It's kind of heavy with it, with No More Deaths. It's actually being able to suss this out and point out what has been happening. You know, the fact that the Border Patrol, it wasn't just looking at the immigrants and chasing them down, but there actually was, and it's not, that wasn't a laugh of kind of like, oh, isn't this funny? It was actually like, this is outrageous. The fact that the Border Patrol actually is on somewhat of a mission without caring, basically, when they, like, for instance, they've been exposed as having, you know, broken, you know, the water containers, or there was this one thing you had on your site of this Border Patrol guy kind of snide and sneering and emptying cartons of water out on the ground, knowing that those were put there for the people, the migrants that were trying to come in and stay alive and get where they were going. And he was basically saying, to hell with that. And let's talk about that a little, because that says a lot about what's actually going on here. It's not sort of just violating rules or something like that, but there actually seems to be a very genocidal approach to this thing on the part of the border guards and the system itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're taught to dehumanize the people that they're interacting with. They're taught to be afraid of them and think that they're all criminals and evil. And they, I think some of them have convinced themselves that that's true. And so the way that they then respond to our aid and what they think that that represents is they believe it's furthering people's presence in the U.S. And it makes sense that that's how they respond to it, because that's what they are being told and taught and being ingrained with. And it's, I don't think that they could do that job if they weren't able to convince themselves of those truths. So,
mm-hmm. Well, when you look at that and you combine it with now the, what is it? I read something in one of your publications. I read something about the various military forces that have come together, military and quasi-military forces that have come together to actually carry out this campaign against immigrants.
You're talking about kind of the border militia groups?
Yeah.
They're definitely present as well, and there's a pretty violent and racist history of them in southern Arizona. I'm in one of the communities that we often work in, the town of Aravaca. A while back, the Minutemen were very active there, and members of the Minutemen militia actually participated in a home invasion. They had heard that this man, Raul Flores, had $1 million in his house and was involved in drug smuggling, and they actually raided his house, shot his 9-year-old daughter, Briseño Flores, and his wife was armed and shot back and called 911 and survived. But, you know, I think some of these militia movements, we talk about Border Patrol not being accountable, they're even less accountable. And the people who are involved with them, I think, are just really scary and unpredictable. And it's kind of this added layer of violence that has really flourished under the Trump administration and been really validated from the top and by individual Border Patrol agents on the ground as well.
I saw a report that also indicated that, like, portions of the U.S. military were actually involved in some of this.
The military has been deployed. There's a lot of limitations in what they're able to do. They are not able to enforce immigration law, but they have been installing razor wire and there was a couple of videos that surfaced of them doing kind of like mob and riot control demonstrations in Nogales on the border. So there were just like lines of members of the army with these huge shields chanting right at the port of entry. They shut down all but one lane of traffic. So there's been kind of these like shows of force, but they are somewhat limited in what they're actually able to do on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, too, is that in terms of getting a permit, like even you folks getting a permit to be able to go into the area that we're talking about, I read that the creation of the permit language, which was a joint effort. This is what it was. It was a joint effort of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, U.S. Air Force, U.S. Marines, and the Bureau of Land Management. That's a pretty big-sized grouping of schmucks.
So it's a interagency permit. So they all kind of came together and did it and, updated the language. Sometimes we go on to public areas of the Barry M. Goldwater Range. There's areas that they're not actively bombing that we can go on, and sometimes we'll go out there. But I think most of the bombing range, there's absolutely no public access. And the times that humanitarian aid groups or search and rescue groups have been able to go out there, it's been indicative of that being kind of just a massive graveyard. The Águilas del Desierto, which is a search and recovery group out of San Diego, has gone out there a couple weekends out onto the Barry M. Goldwater Range, and they had a weekend where they came across the remains of 11 different people who had died just in one weekend. So our group has not gained access to those areas at all, but we do know that a lot of people have gone missing out there.
Mm, boy. When you're talking about this, I can't imagine it, okay? It's like you know what happens to people, and you've probably seen the bodies, you've probably seen the bones. The route taken through this whole National Wildlife Refuge that we're talking about people going through is one of the deadliest corridors for immigrants. And I wanted to talk about that a little bit, because when you think about that in relation to what you just said, to me it raises up a question of a genocidal side of all this.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's just kind of all of these policies in collusion together. So you look at people who end up going missing on the bombing range, they're only walking on the bombing range because of U.S. border policy that has walled off the cities and funneled migration into these remote corridors. You know, you ask the question, well, why don't they apply the legal way? And hopefully we all know that that's impossible for most people and that our asylum process doesn't function. And then we look at, well, why did they even come to the border in the first place? And often those root causes have to do with U.S. imperialism and our foreign policy and the way we've treated Latin America over the past century. So I think all these things together do have kind of a targeting effect of making it so that we ensure that certain groups of people are not going to live full, wonderful lives. They're going to be forced into poverty and kept there. And if they try to escape that, the only way to do that is by walking 90 miles in 110 degree heat and risking death. So, you know, yeah, the options are really limited. And it's hard for me to not see the United States as one of the really, really responsible entities in that.
Mm-hmm. The government has charged the people that they've arrested and put on trial with misdemeanors, which not only covers up the reality of what's being carried out by the system on a regular basis, the stuff that you're speaking to, but also has huge implications for humanitarian work that's involved in aiding migrants in the immediate and long-term future as well. Let's talk about that a little bit, because it does actually, when they're charging people with this and they're accusing people of actually breaking the law in a way that cannot be allowed, let's talk about what that actually means. What is this trial going to mean for the work among migrants in the immediate and long-term future?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think it's already had an effect. I myself was banned from the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge for a year. I put water out there and was honest with an agent out there because we are a transparent organization. And then I was put on a do not issue permit list, and I was on it for a year and just got off this past July. So it's hard for me to think about what I should do because I want to put water on Cabeza Prieta, but I also know that I'm a part of the search and rescue, search and recovery team. And if I am not able to get a permit, that's an issue because I know the area well and I've spent a lot of time out there and I'm capable of leading a search for somebody. And so in order to continue being able to do searches, I have to limit my role in trying to prevent those searches from being necessary in the first place, if that makes any sense. It's this pretty awful situation to be in. And I think a lot of us long-term people are kind of in that spot where we don't want to put water out there right now because we know that we might get banned for life and that our ability to access that land for search and rescue is really key and helpful because the government's not going to do that work. So I think these charges can have a really chilling effect, and they can really limit the work that we're doing out there. I think they also have the ability to really bring us together and kind of show the true colors of the Department of the Interior and show how complicit they are and the ways in which they're utilizing environmental law and conservation ideas to further dehumanize and prosecute and target and just do all of these negative things that at the end of the day have really deadly consequences. You know, I don't want to have our volunteers be charged. I don't want to be in trial. And there's been moments where I'm also feel really thankful that we're being able to be put in the spotlight and tell this story, because a lot of the people that have been really directly affected by this aren't able to tell that story because they're not with us anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, for the people out there that want to know one really important question, what now? What lies ahead now?
Well, next week I have a 2-day hike plan on Sabesa. We're going to go out there and we're going to spend the night in the Growler Valley, and we're going to hike in some of these areas that we know are high needs. And the work continues. This week we're out putting out water in the Aravaca area. We've committed to providing humanitarian aid, and we're going to continue to do that. We're just going to have to kind of figure out the most effective way to intervene in this crisis. And now we have, you know, an additional factor, which is being targeted by the government. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to add that into our list of what we consider and continue our work because we can't stop.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean for the people that are facing charges and possibility of being in jail right now? And how can people actually express their support if they want to support that?
Yeah, well, people can write letters if they want to. We have a P.O. box. People can donate. We're big on social media. And, yeah, I think a lot of them are scared and, you know, we're unsure of what's going to happen. But we're also, you know, we're all together. We're hanging out at a friend's house right now and just kind of continuing with our lives and being optimistic. And I think at the end of the day, when I've talked to everybody about it, they know that what they did was the right thing to do. And they know that whatever the law was, whatever the government says the rules were and what was broken and what wasn't, I feel so humbled by the things that I've heard them say on the stand over the past few days. You know, people saying that they respond to like a higher calling and like a higher morality than what U.S. environmental law says in this case, or, you know, people just recognizing that water is such a sacred thing and that when people are dying of thirst, you have to put water out for them. I think everybody's in good spirits. We're going to see what comes.
And people should be really paying a lot of close attention to this because there's two more trials at least coming up. You know, there's the continuation of the trial that we've been talking about. There's the four other people that are going to be put on trial. And
yep.
Then Scott, yes. And those things are important for people to have the backs of the people being charged and put on trial. And I think that's really important for people to figure out ways that they can actually, how they can actually follow the trials, how they can show their support. How would that be?
One of our defendants I remember talking to, and she's absolutely amazing. But I think what she kind of said to me was, she told me, I want people to keep doing the work. She was like, I'm going to be fine, but I want people to keep doing the work. And so I guess I would, for folks kind of across the country, I think that's maybe the message to take away is keep track, watch what's happening to us and support us in the ways that you can, but also engage in your own community because we're out here on the border, but the border affects people everywhere. And in any community you're in across the country, there's undocumented people there that are being targeted right now. And so you don't need to come to Arizona to engage in this work. Anybody that you can keep in your community and prevent from being deported, that's one less person that we need to put water out for. So, you know, I think people should just look around at what's available to them, what connections they already have in their community, and engage there.
All right, Paige, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
And we'll definitely stay in touch. It's really important talking about this, and it's been good talking with you.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot, Paige. All right, welcome back. That was, actually an extremely important piece that people need to keep their eyes on. They need to keep their eyes on what's developing in that and overall, and in particular with the other trials coming up. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. right, welcome back. That was Outer National, Somos Todos Ilegales. All right, now for most of us, we're really keenly aware of what's been going on in relation to the situation developing in this country right now and the various nodal points that are happening. And right now, I wanted to run something that I think is extremely important. And this is a piece done by Bob Avakian, and he's the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it really speaks very dramatically and powerfully to the question of women and the oppression of women and what where it comes from and what do we need to do, all right? So this is it comes from a speech that Avakian made called, and a recording that's available called, a film that's available actually, called B.A. Speaks, Revolution Nothing Less, a speech by Bob Avakian in the fall of 2012. So let's just jump right into that and we'll be right back after that.
At the same time, millions of women and girls are enslaved in prostitution and in the degradation of the ever more vicious and violent pornography, many forced into this as well, not only out of economic hardship, but literal brutality. A number of years ago, I gave a talk called Unresolved Contradictions, Driving Forces for Revolution. And in that, I spoke to the fact that a comrade in our party had pointed out to me in relation to an earlier talk I gave, Revolution, why it's necessary, why it's possible, and what it's all about, that there was a very real and vivid parallel between the situation of women, particularly in pornography and prostitution, and the way the phenomenon that I described in beginning that talk, Revolution. I began that talk with descriptions of the postcards of the hanging. Now, think about this. Literally in this country, up until the 1950s and into the early 1960s. In many of our lifetimes, black people were being repeatedly lynched. But that's not all. Usually this took place in the South. And many times when these black men in particular would be lynched, it would be done in a carnival atmosphere. People would be notified in advance that this was going to happen. People, whole families, including little children, would come to picnic at the site of the lynching. And when the black man's body was lynched, mutilated, and burned, pieces of the mutilated body would be handed out to some in the crowd as trophies. This is the f***ing history of this country. And I know it's hard to hear, but we need to face the reality of what the history of this country and how it's been built actually is. And then photographs would be taken of the burned, mutilated, and lynched bodies of these black men. And postcards would be made and they would be sold around the country. And this comrade pointed out, and I spoke to this in Unresolved Contradictions, Driving Forces for Revolution, that what goes on, particularly in the increasingly violent and vicious pornography, is very much along the same lines as the postcards of the hanging. The titillation of men through the physical torture and degradation of women, which is becoming more and more the norm and more mainstream in pornography. We should all think about the fact that one of the most popular forms of pornography as it's being more and more mainstream is rape pornography, depicting literally the woman being raped. And this comrade also pointed out, and I think it's very important to think about, that you can do in this society today to women what you could not do to any other group without a huge outcry. I mean, think about what's depicted in pornography, even so-called softcore, let alone hardcore, vicious and violent pornography. Imagine if someone made a film depicting black people in grotesque caricature with gigantic teeth and a big smile eating watermelons. and dancing around saying, yes, Amasa, yes, Amasa. Can you imagine that you could have that done without a huge outcry? No, and that's very right. It should not be able to be done without a huge outcry. Or imagine if you literally showed lynchings and depicted them as a source of titillation. But yet you can do what I've been describing in pornography, and not only is there not a huge outcry, but it's being more and more mainstream. And by the way, it's multi-billion dollar business. It's not just some sleazy old men in San Fernando Valley who are turning this out. This involves big banks and financial institutions. It involves big hotel chains involved in multi-billion dollar business. And it's becoming more, as I said, more and more mainstream. Even the television programs, which are not pornographic themselves, literally. How often do you hear when talking about guys, oh, let's watch some porn? It's just integrated into the story as if it's just perfectly natural. And then think about the content that I've been just touching on and can't really give full life to. I mean, it's just so disgusting. So outrageous. Think about this content that's being mainstreamed. And along with this, women are subjected to continual assaults on their right to abortion and even birth control. Don't let these people tell you, these so-called right-to-lifers, that the issue is the killing of innocent babies. The issue is the control over women exercised by forcing them to be mothers, whether or not they want to be at that time. Now, to have children, to raise children, can be a really beautiful experience if that's what you want to do and if you feel in a position to do it in the way that you feel that it should be done. But to have it forced on you is virtual enslavement. Not to even have the choice as to whether you will do that. And here's the key to how you know, or one key to how you know this is not about killing of innocent babies. Try to find one of these rabid anti-abortion groups that is also not opposed to birth control. You'll have a very hard time. They're all opposed to birth control because the issue is not the killing of innocent babies. It's the control and subordination of women who are regarded as getting all out of hand these days in this society. Which is another reason why we have, or a contributing factor to why we have this vicious pornography. So the goal of these attacks on abortion and, yes, on birth control, the right to them, is to deny women the ability to determine something as basic as when or if they will have children and raise children or be part of raising them, forcing motherhood on them once again and enslaving them in that way. Along with all this, millions of women and girls, millions every year in this country alone, are raped, assaulted, battered, and abused, often by those who claim to be their intimate lovers, while the half of humanity that is female is everywhere treated as less than fully human. Once again, I think about the experience of black people and slavery. You know what one of the main terms the slave owners used to describe the slaves? Talking tools. Because this is how they regarded them, and this is how they were treated. They were put on the auction block to be sold, and their physical attributes were examined. Their teeth, if they were women, their reproductive potential. Their body shapes, their ability to work hard, their musculature. All this was examined in the most degrading way. And you think of the same thing with women today. Reduced to objects to be used by men. Treated as brood animals to turn out babies. And as unthinking flesh to be consumed and plundered with their bodies and body parts used to sell products, pimped out and beaten into submission, plundered to portray and promote sex as conquest and domination by men instead of shared pleasure based on mutual affection and equality. All of this degrades and demeans not only the women who are directly subjected to the most extreme forms of this, but all women everywhere. What kind of system is this? And why should anyone accept that this is the best possible way the world could be? And those whose sexual orientation is different from and seen as posing a threat to the dominant gender and sex relations, lesbians and gays, bisexual and transgendered people, or those who are simply unsure about their sexuality and questioning it at a given time, are harassed, bullied, often bullied to the point of committing suicide, brutalized and even murdered. And despite certain changes in law and government policy, the reality of LGBT people being discriminated against, insulted, and even assaulted continues as a marked feature of the culture and society, bound up with deep-seated structural relations of this whole system, closely connected to the patriarchy and male supremacy that oppress women.
All right, real quick, that's really very, very, very important. That was Bob Avakian talking about the oppression of women. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my guests today, Alvaro Huerta and Paige Courage-Klein, and Bob Avakian for the piece on the oppression of women. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
I wanna hear your thoughts, see it all. I can hear the waves through the walls. You wanna go out tonight, you want to know what it's like when the wind's in your lungs.